a better way.
We are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3579 of the Survival Podcast. I'm jazzed about today's show. I get to bring back on the air one of my favorite people to have conversations with, especially conversations about history and how it relates to now. And, of course, that is Professor C.J. Kilmer of the Dangerous History Podcast. We're going to be talking in this particular episode about the fall of the Soviet Empire, along with a new course that CJ's putting together that you'll find out how to take today, where you can learn all about this at a level that you probably can't learn about it anywhere else. But we're going to do our best to give you an overview of it today. And I want to talk about this with you guys, because for all the talk of the Roman Empire, I mean, when we talk about the situation that we're in right now as a country, when we talk about kind of the end of a century, really, almost of decadence in this country, and certainly the last 50 years since 1971, what always comes up is Rome. Often you'll hear about Weimar Republic, which I think is a really bad example because the crisis there only lasted actually a very brief period of time, and it didn't result in the dissolution of the country either. But when I look at all of the empire collapses that I'm familiar with, the one that seems to bear the most resemblance to our current situation, to me anyway, is the Soviet Union. Maybe not for the same reasoning behind the type of government that was there, but I think the reason that it looks so similar is because we're in the same place from a technological and economic standpoint, modern economic systems, et cetera. And I guess the other corollary, and maybe we'll even chat a little bit about this, would be the British Empire's collapse. Both of those are much more recent, and therefore, I believe, much more analogous to what we're going through right now. And if you doubt the United States is an empire, even though we're going to be talking about the dissolution of the Soviet Empire today, I think by the time we're done, you will no longer argue that the United States is not currently an empire. I don't think there's any way to argue your way out of that mess. Before I bring CJ on, let's just go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day. And sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone. If you want to take back your tech from the big carriers, the big device makers, and the big app makers, then you need to get on over to Above Phone. Remember, if you're an MSB member, $75 off any phone at AbovePhone.com. They also have some pretty amazing laptops available now as well. And you have your own private ecosystem to get your apps from. But check, I need this one app or these two apps that absolutely I can only get on Google Play or the iOS store or whatever. That's okay. It's okay. All you have to do is you create a little jail on your Above Phone. You put those apps in there, and they only get to do what they do when you let them do it. So you can bring them up and use them when you need to. But you might be surprised at how few of those you really will need. But, Jack, I can't do this. It's too hard. You're a technical wizard, as my web dude Tom laughs his ass off every time people say that. I'm not a technical person really at all. But I will tell you this. It is a little bit of a learning curve. But if you want an Above Phone and you want to not worry about it, know this. They will give you free consulting to help you transition, you know, in a positive way, transition over to using your own private ecosystem and your own Above Phone. Next up today, before we bring CJ on, let's talk about your wealth and investing your wealth in a way that makes sense. Well, you can learn more about that at the Wealth Studying Podcast. It's at wealthstudying.com with John Pugliano. John has been part of this community probably since 2009, but I've known of him since 2010. That's 14 years that I've been working with John one way or another. I first met him at a prepper convention in Salt Lake City, Utah, and he was just starting out his investment management services. And he told me, he said, I know you don't really like investment managers and investment advisors and all, but I'm not a financial liar. I made myself a liquid millionaire before I take a dime of anybody else's money working a regular job. And now I'm going to go out and start doing this for other people. And that started up a friendship. He's not just a great investment manager, though, and a great investor. He's also a really great dude and a great prepper. I mean, this guy is a ham radio operator. He does the gardening, the food storage, all of it. You can learn more, again, at wealthstudying.com. It's a great podcast, and you should be checking it out. It only comes out about once a week, once every 2 weeks, 15, 20 minutes long, just the stuff you need to know. So get on over and subscribe to John's podcast. With that, let's bring another podcaster on air with us. host of the Dangerous History Podcast, my good friend, fellow Goose. We just had our Goose reunion yesterday, CJ Kilmer. CJ, welcome to the Survival Podcast. You're muted, CJ. You're muted.
It's amateur hour. Sorry about that. Thanks for having my amateur ass back on.
Oh, well, glad to have you on. For those that haven't heard from you in the past on air with us or haven't checked out your podcast, what the hell is the CJ Kilmer? Where do you find one? What do you do with them when you get one? No, seriously, like, what is your backstory like? How did you get into this line of work, you know, historical analysis?
Sure. So born and raised a Florida man, so that's a good place to start looking if you want to find a CJ Kilmer. And I was one of those people that went to college just because that's like what everyone was saying you're supposed to do. And, you know, I had pretty good grades and very good test scores and whatever. So I was like, all right, you know, path of least resistance. And oh man, you gotta pick a major. Okay. So I don't know. I didn't have any real strong thing. Like I definitely want to be in this career or that career or whatever. So I was like, well, I'll take something that I'm interested in. And so I went with history. Partly because I had, you know, one really good history teacher in middle school and another really good one in high school. So it just made me interested. I was already like reading history books on my own when I was a teenager. So I went and got a history bachelor's degree and I was like, well, there's not a whole lot you can do with that other than be the most like historically knowledgeable barista at the Starbucks. So I went on to graduate school. I was originally intending to go all the way through to a PhD, but for a variety of reasons, I didn't end up doing that. I got a master's degree in history, though. And then I went to work, and the best full-time job you can get in academia with a master's degree is going to be at a, what used to be called until recently, a community college. And so that's what I did. I taught community college history for 15 years, and that was my thing, but I never fit in very well with academia because I like to actually think for myself. I like to actually question things. And the more you tell me that I'm not allowed to question something, the more I'm going to question that thing. And so, you know, I was already kind of libertarian leaning, conservatarian, something like that. But then, you know, the more I spent time really digging into history deeply and going far beyond even what you often learn in, you know, a history major program, the more I started to realize that, like, I wasn't a radical enough libertarian that like, the more I learned about history, the more I was like, I think I might be an anarchist because these people are all a bunch of, you know, lying psychopaths. so there you go. Way back around 2014, in summer of 2014, I finally, after thinking about it for several years, I finally said, I'm going to start me one of those podcasts and see how that goes. So I started the Dangerous History Podcast. And it was just sort of like a hobby experiment initially, and it kind of gradually grew into a side hustle for me. And eventually in 2022, I walked away from my teaching position because I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, the COVID madness had accelerated a number of trends that I didn't like that were happening already. And so I stepped away from that. And yeah, been doing the Dangerous History Podcast now for a little bit over 10 years. And trying to build it further. You know, I'm currently making my second attempt to make it into a full-time gig for myself. So we'll see how that goes.
Awesome. It's a tough thing to do to get to where you can earn a living as a podcaster. But once you do it, it's totally worth it because it is better than any job. I will tell you that after doing it for 16 years. But we're here today to talk about the fall of the Soviet Empire. So, you know, I lived through this and I was old enough to pay attention, but I was also in a position where I wasn't paying a tremendous amount of attention. I graduated high school. I joined the Army in 1989. Reagan had given his famous tear down that wall speech, right? And Bush, old man Bush, was president, and I went off to the Army, and then all eyes were on very quickly the Middle East and Iran. When you're in the military, you kind of pay attention to what they tell you. You don't really, especially when you're overseas, you don't like sit down and watch TV every night or anything like that. We had one channel, it was AFES, which is just reruns of sitcoms and soap operas mostly, and a little bit of news. And so I kind of missed the whole collapse of the Soviet Union tear down the wall actually being torn down. Like, I got home and the world was different. In the first Olympics that I watched after getting home, there was a Ukrainian team and a Lithuanian team. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, it really didn't sink for me. And it was like, oh yeah, I know that happened, but it wasn't real. And so it seems like it happened overnight. But what I'm interested from a historical perspective, when did the actual collapse really begin? Because I don't think it started when Reagan did his speech, and I don't think it started, you know, when Bush took over. I think that it predates that, and it came in phases.
Yeah, I think you could make an argument that maybe the Soviet Empire began declining like as soon as it was established, as soon as the Bolsheviks won the Civil War and asserted control over the country. Now, you know, not to say that it was like a linear line downward, because there's still the Soviet regime did accomplish a lot of things. I mean, it did put the first satellite in space and the first man in space. Mm-hmm. And it did, you know, a number of other important inventions and discoveries and whatever. And there was genuine economic growth of a sort at various times throughout the Soviet, you know, Soviet Empire's existence. And partly it's just because Russia was such an impoverished, backward country, you know, from under the czars, that, you know, if you could even just start giving some of the people in the countryside electricity, like, yeah, that was a giant step forward. And, you know, a lot of the communists, like the 5-year plans under Joseph Stalin and whatever, they had all kinds of problems for sure. And, you know, there was the occasional intentional famine and whatnot. But, you know, if you measure it by just like gross metrics, like, oh yeah, they're now, you know, producing way more electricity than they used to. A much higher percentage of people have things like running water and electricity than used to. So, you know, there was some actual economic growth and even some improvement over.
But during that time in history, most of that shit was going to happen no matter what kind of government you had, because that's when all that stuff was actually being developed and rolled out.
Oh, for sure.
But they get to take credit for it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part of why communism has tended to be more successful when it gets established in a really, really poor country, because the bar is so low.
Yeah.
You know, that like when communism takes over in Cuba or takes over in Vietnam or whatever, it's like, The country is so poor that, like, even if you just, you know, like I said, increase how many people have access to electricity, it's going to make people, at least for the time being, feel like, hey, this new regime, like, yeah, it's kind of mean, kind of authoritarian sometimes, but, you know, as long as you keep your head down and don't say the wrong thing, you can usually avoid the gulag. But hey, look at this, you know, we had no electricity anywhere in my district, and now we do. And, you know, you could point to things like, you know, in a country where everybody was illiterate, now suddenly some people can read. Like, you know, they do things like that that at least give people a sense of, like, this is going somewhere. No, it doesn't last. But, you know, you could argue that, I would argue that imperialism is never a long-term sustainable strategy, that imperialism eventually always leads to, you know, its own downfall. And as evidence of this, I would say that no empire has ever existed in history that didn't eventually collapse.
Hmm.
But, you know, how long an empire does last before it declines and falls is dependent on a whole bunch of other variables, including like the internal structure and policies of the system. So the Soviets, by embarking on a policy of imperialism, and it very much was an empire, you know, Americans, they look at the map and they see Russia and they think, like, oh, it's a country called Russia where everybody in it is Russian. But no, actually, it was a very multi-ethnic empire. Not only did the Soviet Union include things that today are separate countries, like, you know, Kazakhstan and all those sorts of places, but even within the territory that we think of as Russia, like, there's huge numbers of people, especially in the East, but, you know, in other places too, that are not Russian, that are ethnically different, that, you know, maybe look more Asian than we think of Russians looking, maybe, you know, Russian language isn't their primary language. That goes all the way back to the Tsar. So, yeah. You've got this multi-ethnic empire that the Bolsheviks take over after they overthrow the Tsar and then win a civil war. And theoretically, they could have presided over breaking the Tsarist empire up into smaller pieces or something like that. And they kind of pretended to do that a little bit with this whole idea of, you know, separate Soviet republics or whatever. But in reality, it was all, you know, ruled at the end of the day from Moscow. And there was like a Russian dominance. So you've already got imperialism, which I would say is like never an indefinitely sustainable policy. It eventually runs into overstretch and, you know, you overextend yourself beyond your resources and things. But then also they adopted, you know, communism as their economic platform, which made their empire, I think, destined to not last as long as a lot of other empires in history. Because you can have your empire stick around a lot longer if you have a relatively more free market, you know, internal system. So like the British Empire, for example, was around a long time and, you know, was pretty huge for a while. And part of that is because they had relatively free market economic policies for the most part, you know, compared to other empires like the Soviets. But communism has so many, you know, internal problems as an economic system that cause it to be not just not as productive as a market system, but also like the communists, they were often good because you could use central planning. Let me try and explain this. You can use central planning to like do one big brute force kind of a goal. Like, all right, comrade, this year we're going to produce more tons of steel than we've ever produced before.
Okay.
And like central planning can do that. You could just, sure, you know, just incentivize and threaten everybody until they, oh yeah, we made more metric tons of steel. So
but that comes from somewhere else. Like the energy that would be used to do that came from something else that doesn't get done. And then what do we do with all the steel?
Exactly. So the two problems of communism that people point to the most often, probably the one that gets most attention, is the incentive problem, right? Which is, hey, if you know your pay isn't based on merit and all that, then what's to incentivize you from, you know, working your ass off and really, you know, giving it 110% and whatever? So people are just going to be lazier and less productive because they don't have the incentives to work. Now, you know, the Soviets could get around that somewhat by kind of offering you little goodies and treats and awards for working hard, and also, you know, propagandizing you, and also ultimately threatening you with the gulag or worse if, you know, you're not doing what you're told. But then the other problem that you can't solve, even with propaganda and force and bribery, is what the Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises called the calculation problem, which is exactly what you were alluding to a moment ago, which is, even if you can solve the incentive problem and through a combination of propaganda, terror, or whatever, create a new Soviet man who works his ass off for the common good without, you know, the incentives of a capitalist system, you still have the problem of how do you know what to produce? How do you know, like, of the tons of steel your country is producing, how do you know, like, what kinds of steel to produce? You know, because if you, every ton of ore that you devote to making one kind of steel is no longer available to make another kind of steel. And then even once the steel is made, what does it get made into? Who decides how much, steel goes to making, you know, hammers, how much steel goes to making railroad tracks, how much steel goes to, like, you know, anything else? And in a market system, that gets sorted out by supply and demand and, you know, consumers voting with their dollars and, then, you know, entrepreneurs responding to those incentives and saying, oh, look, you know, they want to buy more cars than hammers. Great. Let's make sure more steel, you know, goes into this versus that. Like, there's no central planner in a capitalist system. It's individual companies responding to, you know, their understanding of what demand is for certain things. And that allocates the resources. And so, you know, we take it for granted, or we did until the last few years, that, you know, if you go to the store, as long as you have money, stuff will be there that you want. That, you know, you go to the store and if you have a few bucks and you want toilet paper, there will be toilet paper. But in a communist system, that's not always true. And in a communist system, the resources are directed by politicians and bureaucrats as part of the central planning mechanism.
We got kind of a little glimpse of that, didn't we, around like early 2020 when we stopped producing, and to a large degree, we reduced importing, and then we gave everybody money. So we all had money, but, you know, it's funny you mentioned toilet paper, but that's the shit that I saw people, like, literally, like, arm-barring each other and shit in Costco for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of that great essay, I think it's by Leonard Reed, that essay, I, Pencil, which, you know, anybody can Google it up. It's floating around out there all over the place. And the whole idea is that, you know, in a market system, it's really a fascinating miracle just how much we take for granted as far as nobody actually knows how to make a pencil. By which I mean nobody knows like all the steps and does all the steps. You know, you got one company that, you know, cuts down the wood and gets that ready. Another company, you know, does the lead or the graphite, and then another company puts it together and whatever. And all these things happen with no central planner, with no overlord ordering, make a pencil and do it this way and use these resources, just by, you know, entrepreneurs responding to what they believe consumer demand is. And not only are there pencils, you know, this thing that takes lots of different kinds of knowledge and resources combined together to make something as mundane as a pencil. But not only are they everywhere, they're so cheap that they're almost free. Like a regular old wood, you know, grind in the sharpener pencil. I mean, is what, even in today's inflated dollars, it's like a quarter or something.
But you're right. It comes like somebody has to make the little piece of metal that the eraser goes in. Somebody has to make the rubber that becomes the eraser. Somebody has to make the wood framing that the lead goes into. The lead has to be made, which is actually graphite and what have you. And then it has to be packaged and it has to be shipped. And somehow this happens with nobody saying, thou shall make pencils. The market responds to the need. And to me, what destroys things, the more you move towards socialism, is the more you corrupt the signal.
Yep.
So markets are a signal. Markets are what tells a company, cut some employees before next quarter, hire some employees for next quarter. Invest in this, don't invest in that. Take on a line of credit, don't take on a like these decisions are made because the market sends signals and they pay very talented people to look at those signals and say, this isn't what's going to happen, but this is what's most likely to happen. And the more you corrupt that signal, then the less ability there is of the market to respond. And even if you say, well, we're not a fully managed economy, like people can still have their own thing, but we're going to manage this. Now you fuck that signal up.
Yep.
Now that those people that could be making other goods don't trust the signal. They don't want to invest because they don't trust the signal. And therefore you have shortages of some and surpluses of others. And you can't ever get it right because the signal's corrupt. If I give you a Geiger counter, it'll keep you from poisoning yourself if you're prospecting in the desert. But if it doesn't work, you're walking around with, you know, uranium in your pocket irradiating your balls, right? That's the best way I can explain it.
Yeah, it's very fragile, the sort of supply chain responding to supply and demand. And it's able to, though, even though it's fragile and it's easily messed up, you know, by political meddling, at the same time, if it's left to its own devices, it's very resilient because it relies on widely dispersed knowledge. So, you know, you don't have to know necessarily what's going on economically in the world to be able to respond to price signals, right? So, you know, if tomorrow there suddenly is like a massive, a massive pork shortage, let's say, consumers don't need to know that there's a pork shortage or why it's happening. All they have to do is like, if they see the price of pork suddenly skyrocketing, they're going to naturally just say, all right, I guess this week we're getting turkey bacon. And they're going to, you know, shift over to that.
And the farmer that has a bunch of pigs that he was holding a little bit longer to finish might say, this is the time to dump my pigs.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I would say there's a case to be made that the Soviet Empire started declining in a way right away.
Yeah.
You know, I think Americans have a tendency to often think of the Soviet Union as being like this consistent monolith that didn't change from like 1920 until 1980 or something like that. But the reality is, you know, it changed a lot, you know, from decade to decade, depending on who was in charge and what else was happening in the world.
That's a product of our education. I believe that when I was in school, because it was taught to me that way. These are, you know, stuck in this mired thing. And if they have technology, it's because they stole it from us. Like that's basically was my opinion of the Soviet Union in the 80s as a kid in school.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency for people to see it sort of like the Borg on Star Trek or something like this, where it's just like this monolith. But, you know, the reality is that each different Soviet leader had his own, you know, different personality and different priorities. And there was always internal politics. That's something that often gets overlooked, is that, like, even the guy who's nominally the leader, you know, the general secretary of the Communist Party and therefore the top guy in the Soviet Union, he still has to worry about various constituencies.
Yeah.
Like, he still has to worry, am I keeping my version of the Pentagon happy? Am I keeping, you know, this special interest or that special interest happy? You know, is the guy who's running the KGB right now, are he and I on good terms to where I can trust him and he can trust me? Like, there still was politics. It just was different, although not as different as Americans might think, because I would argue, in practice, the Soviet government was an oligarchy and so was the American government.
Correct.
Just the Soviet government was a little bit more kind of obvious about it in a lot of ways. But, you know, they suffered horribly in World War II. They're the country that lost more people than anybody else in that war.
Like, I believe, especially if you take out the Holocaust and you just take it as combat losses, I think they lost more than, like, almost everybody else combined or something. It was, like, at least in the European theater, like, it was massive, massive numbers of losses.
Yeah, millions and millions, you know, I don't even know. I'll try and do a little bit of looking before I teach my course on this to see if I can come up with what I think are the most accurate ones. But, you know, I've seen estimates 20-some million, counting both soldiers and civilians slaughtered in World War II by the Nazis. So they came out of World War II, like, they won, but it was a very costly victory for them in a way that most Americans, I don't think, appreciated. The United States lost fewer than a million guys in World War II, actually far fewer than a million guys in World War II. And meanwhile, the Soviets lost like 20 some million or thereabouts. So, and they had like lots of their cities, you know, destroyed by
Stalingrad. The estimates are like between 1.1 and 1.9 million. Just one battle, they lost somewhere between 1 and 2 million people.
Yep.
One battle.
Yep.
I.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the aftermath of World War II, they were in a weird situation, the Soviets, because on the one hand, they had a lot of prestige internationally. A lot of like other countries looked on them pretty favorably because they had done the bulk of the fighting of the Nazis, you know, roughly 90% of German soldiers killed in World War II are killed by the Russians on the Eastern Front. Roughly 90%. So, and people in the aftermath of World War II kind of understood that. I think this got forgotten over the course of the Cold War due to propaganda.
You remember Hogan's Heroes?
Oh, yeah.
What was the ultimate punishment that could happen to one of the Germans? Be sent to the Russian front. That was like, it was like total terror. They would be sent to the front.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Stalin, like on paper, he had the biggest army in the world. He had just, you know, defeated the Nazis, but he knew that his country had been severely damaged. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he had this sort of like strategy of being aggressive, almost in like a compensating kind of a way. Like, I know I'm weak, so I don't want them to realize how weak I am. So I'm going to act like I'm invulnerable and, you know, be kind of aggressive. And yet at the same time, like, Stalin was usually very cautious as soon as he came up against like solid opposition. But then Stalin died in the 50s. And, you know, then it was a question of he had been in charge for so long. It was a question of like, what's the Soviet system going to be now? Khrushchev came in and actually did. A lot of Americans don't know this. Khrushchev actually started to do various types of liberalizations in the Soviet Union. He called it de-Stalinization. Did make the regime a little bit less, you know, horrible and authoritarian. Like, I'm not saying it was great, but compared to under Stalin, it was a little bit more tolerant and, you know, not quite as mass slaughtery all the time. And, you know, they had, again, certain things that central planning can do well, like we're going to funnel every resource we have to into the space program so that we get to space before the Americans. Like, you know, central planning can sometimes do those things relatively well because those are economic questions where you don't really have to worry about consumer preferences and whatever like that. So,
but who's going to buy the rocket?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
We're building the rocket to send it to space. We don't have to sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it looked often in the 50s and 60s, like the Soviet Union was, you know, doing well. And, you know, and of course, part of it's their own propaganda, too. They were always pumping out propaganda to the rest of the world. Sometimes based on true stuff, but still misleading, where it'd be like, look, comrade, we now have, you know, all five of the largest power plants in Earth are in the Soviet Union. Isn't that something? And, you know, even in cases where that was true, then the question would be like, okay, yeah, but, you know, a huge percentage of your people cannot access toilet paper on a regular basis.
I remember in the 80s, John Stossel went to the Soviet Union on 2020, and he was like trying to get a cab. He was holding up like a wad of Russian money, and no cabs would stop. And he held up a pack of Marlboros. And that car was like instantly, and he figured out he could get anything he wanted for Marlboro cigarettes and Levi's jeans. Mm-hmm. Like, you could do anything in Russia in the 1980s with those two commodities.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, same thing if you had a decent bottle of booze.
Yeah.
That'd be worth its weight in gold.
Were there some ultimate long-term causes, like things that really would you, if you had to put your finger on just a couple things that would be the things that really did them in?
Yeah, I think the biggest one was simply the incentive problem of communism that leads to all these economic imbalances and, you know, surpluses of some things, shortages of others. And, you know, people can put up with that for a while if you give them a good propaganda story. Like in the early days of the Soviet regime, there was a lot of propaganda that would sort of acknowledge that a lot of people were going through like hardships and shortages, but it would be in the guise of, well, comrade, you know, we're going to have to tighten our belts and, you know, suck it up for a little while right now, because we are sacrificing in order to build the glorious socialist utopia of tomorrow. And people can go along with that for a while. Again, especially if there's superficial things that look like that's what's happening, where they're like, you know, oh, look, we have electricity and we didn't before, you know, or we have running water, we didn't before. But, you know, if that goes on long enough, the narrative starts to just no longer hold water. And, you know, even the average kind of dumb propagandized masses in any country eventually kind of realize that the evidence of their own eyes and their own lived experience doesn't match what the propaganda is telling them.
Any father has had the kids say, are we there yet, Dad? Or how long? How much more time? Like, so there's a point on a journey where people start to, like, look out the window and say, okay, so this wonderful place that we're on the way to, when? When is this going to happen?
Yeah, yeah. You keep breaking eggs and you never get the damn omelet.
Yeah.
Is the way I think about it.
You keep breaking somebody else's eggs and they never get an omelet. That's kind of, you know, communism in a nutshell.
Yeah. And the unique, you know, characteristics of a communist system where politics is dominant over economics also, I think, makes it easier for corruption to set in more quickly. If that makes sense, because it becomes like a standard way of doing business. If you want to get anything done, it requires corruption. So, you know, you're running a factory and you need some certain parts for, you know, because you're building, I don't know, cars or something like that.
Yeah.
And you can't get any. And the only way you can get the parts that you need is by like bribing some official that runs another factory that makes those parts that you need. And then, you know, you bribe him with something that you've got that he needs and he, you know, responds and pays you back with the parts that you need. And just in general, it creates a degree of like bureaucratic corruption that grows faster, I think. Not to say that it can't grow in a system like ours with a mixed economy, but I think it grows faster in a communist system than in a somewhat free market system. But, you know, you get to a point where... Well, I should say another thing that caused the Soviet Union to decline is that they ultimately decided to, you know, try to match the United States in the arms race. And
so would you say there's truth to the concept that Reagan outspent them?
Like, yeah.
Is there any validity to? I just watched the Reagan movie with Dennis Quaid, which was a really great movie with some artistic license, obviously, but it was a pretty damn good movie. Mm-hmm. And that point was made in there quite. I don't know if you've seen it. It's actually the narrator is supposedly like an old KGB agent talking to like a new FSB agent about what happened. Like that's the perspective, not that the whole movie's from, but from the portion this narration is told from. Like this guy, and I don't know if there's any truth to it at all because we just watched it. And like the concept is like way back when he was like a Screen Actors Guild president. And still an actor and not doing any politics at all, that this dude had kind of singled him out as like we need to watch this guy. This guy's dangerous, and nobody listened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And as he moved up in politics, nobody listened to him until it was like too late. Mm-hmm. And there was a point in it where I don't think it was Gorbachev. I think it was somebody before him said to Reagan something like, you can't spend us, you know, you can't outspend us. We have just as much money as you, or something like that. There was also a period, and I wonder how this factors into the collapse, where like three Soviet leaders in a row very quickly died.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan says to whoever his chief of staff was or whatever, like, how can I meet with these people if they keep dying?
Yeah.
Right? Like, that had to have something to do with it, I guess.
Yeah. That's something that I see very often in late-stage imperial decline, where there's a tendency of, the average age of your top leaders tends to get higher. And I think part of why that tends to happen is that the more the system becomes like decadent and corrupt and dysfunctional, the more you rising in that system is primarily dependent just on like seniority. It's just like, how long have you been around and how many backs have you scratched? Like, that's the explanation for how Joe Biden wound up in the White House, basically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's basically what I would point to is like, how did Leonid Brezhnev end up in power and stay there so long? It's like same sort of deal. He wasn't that impressive of a guy. He was, you know, kind of mediocre and corrupt and whatever, but he stuck around and he was a survivor and, you know, eventually got to a point where enough people owed him favors and whatever that he was able to take over and run the Soviet Union.
Well, if you think about it, Bill Clinton was the first boomer president. Okay. There are people old enough to be president who weren't born when Clinton was president. I mean, by a hair, but yeah, like there's an entire new generation of millennials that are old enough to be in politics, and the boomers have basically been in control since Clinton till now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The average age of a college president in the United States, if you go back to the 1990s, was like 40 something.
Okay, so now you're into like the non-governmental. Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, just, you know, institutions in general, I think, tend to reflect this trend.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the 1990s, I think the average age of a college president in this country was 40s, early 50s. So basically a boomer.
Mm-hmm.
Now you fast forward, you know, to today, and the average age of a college president in this country is like 70 something.
Yeah.
It's the same people.
They won't go away.
Yeah.
They won't retire. Leave. They won't go off to like feed ice cream to seagulls on the beach or something. I was just reading the second book out of the Fourth Turning. The Fourth Turning is Here or something like that from the one of the authors that's still alive. And he made that point that not only is this in the political space, but people are staying CEOs, college presidents, all of that shit much later in life. And some of these guys have now been in control of these institutions for 30 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I never thought about the corollary. The Soviet system had this very aged, when I asked that question, I wasn't even thinking that way, but that's actually really interesting.
Yeah. I think it's just when the institutions of a country start to get dysfunctional and corrupt, then, you know, your ticket to getting into positions of power and maintaining positions of power within those institutions is going to be more dependent on just like, how long have you been around? Who owes you favors? How much, you know, corruption power have you accumulated? And so you're less likely to rise quickly if you're a young, bright person, you know, go-getter who's just going to rise on merit. That doesn't happen as often when you're in later stage imperial decline. Mm-hmm. So, The 1970s are actually a really interesting time in the Soviet Union. And I should say, one of the things that I'm going to be doing with this course I'm going to be teaching is I'm going to be looking at things almost all from the Soviet perspective and the perspective of like other people who were governed by them, like in the Warsaw Pact, you know, countries and stuff. Because the version of the Cold War and the decline and fall of the Soviet Union that you get in American classrooms is almost always American centric. It's almost always like the real initiative of driving historical events is coming from America, and it's the Soviets who are just sort of like passively responding to that and whatever. And the reality is, you know, you mentioned Reagan before. Like, I do think there's a good case to be made that Reagan's arms buildup and all that stuff probably sped up the collapse of the Soviet Union by forcing it, you know, more quickly into bankruptcy than it otherwise would have been. But I still think communism ultimately defeated itself, and that, you know, the Soviet Empire was not going to last too much longer, regardless of what the U.S. did or didn't do. But the 70s are interesting because the 70s are kind of like a turning point where superficially it looked like the Soviet Union was doing really well. But beneath the surface, all of the problems that would, you know, come to light in the 80s as things really started to unravel were brewing pretty strongly. So in the 70s, it looked like the Soviets were doing well, relatively speaking, and the Americans were sort of on the ropes. You know, the Americans had gotten booted out of Vietnam, and the Soviets had been, you know, helping the communists there. So that was sort of a win for them, even though they were just in a supporting role. And then, you know, the Americans were dealing with lots of economic problems, inflation, things like that, the oil shortages, and, you know, dealing with the political fallout of things like Watergate, a lot of other scandals in the 70s. And by contrast, it looked like the Soviet Union was sort of like on the ascendancy relative to the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we have access to more of what was going on beneath the surface on their side, it's clear that this was not, you know, the reality. That the idea, because the American imperial system was better, economically speaking, than the Soviet system, the American system was able to weather and bounce back from problems like, you know, economic issues or the fallout of losing the Vietnam War, things like this. The American system was more resilient at bouncing back from those sorts of things than the Soviet system. And a big part of what made it look like the Soviets were doing well in the 70s was a temporary thing caused by oil prices. So in the 70s, oil prices, as many people know, shot up, and, you know, there ended up being shortages and rationing and price controls and all that nonsense. And this, you know, hurt the American economy a lot, but it was a boon for the Soviet economy because they were, you know, Russia's a very resource rich country, and they were just starting to really tap into a lot of their best oil resources. And yeah, they weren't, you know, doing it as efficiently as like a modern Western oil company would have done it, but they were doing it. And this was like giving an artificial stimulus shot to the Soviet system. It gave it the illusion. It's like a person who's very unhealthy, has a terminal disease, and like you shoot them up with a whole bunch of, you know, amphetamines, B vitamins, whatever else you got, painkillers. And then they're like, oh man, I'm good, you know?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the cancer.
But they're not. The disease is still, yeah.
Yeah, it's still metastasizing. So
you treated the symptom, not the illness.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's and there were things that superficially made it look like the Soviets were on the march in the 70s, like, you know, the end of the 70s is when they invaded Afghanistan. Well, that was a brilliant idea. But, you know, there were other interventions that they sponsored or supported. You know, the Cubans were in Angola and Africa, a number of other things. And so superficially, you'd be like, oh, no, communism is, you know, on the ascendancy. They're spreading. But they were actually just overextending themselves stupidly. What really happened, I think, was that in the aftermath of Vietnam, for the rest of the 70s and even into the 80s, the U.S. government became, unfortunately only temporarily, much more cautious about foreign interventions. And so much more hesitant to commit in a big way to trying to like counter every single Soviet move around the world. And you might think, oh, that means America's weak. Well, sort of. But it also means that the Soviets are now perceiving that America's weak, and so they're going to push, you know, their hand as much as they can. And in reality, with the benefit of hindsight, I think it now is clear that the Soviets in the 70s overdid it. They overexpanded. They took on too many commitments, not just actual like proxy wars in Afghanistan and elsewhere, but also the like Soviet welfare to their satellites and their imperial possessions increased. And I think they sort of felt like, well, it's, you know, we have all this money, we're doing well because of the high oil prices, given our economy an artificial shot in the arm. And so they took on more commitments. They did the same thing that the U.S. has been doing in recent decades, which is just, you know, acting in foreign policy.
Afghanistan would be an example, right?
Like, exactly. Exactly. They got it.
No gain.
Yeah.
No gain. They not only lost and got nothing out of it. Had they won, they really wouldn't have got much anyway.
Yeah.
Like it was, if they would have won, it would have been a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, for sure. And their empire got more and more like unbalanced. And what I mean by that is even more so than before, the Soviet government was spending more on its empire than it was getting back from them in the form of, you know, plunder and things. And so, you know, if you held up like a balance sheet of like how much money and resources is the Soviet government giving to Cuba versus how much are they getting back from Cuba? And actually it was a losing proposition economically. They were spending more on Cuba than Cuba was giving them back. And the same thing with a lot of the Warsaw Pact states. And interestingly enough, the standard of living was higher in like the colonies basically of the Soviet Union than it was in the Soviet Union itself. So if you were in, you know, East Germany or Poland or someplace like that, the people actually during the Cold War had a higher standard of living in what should be like subservient imperial possessions than the people back at the center of the empire in Russia. And in some ways, it reminds me of the American empire of today, where a lot of, you know, the subservient allies that we have are actually in like per capita wealth terms more prosperous than we are. And it's partly because they get, you know, subsidized. And it's one of the reasons I think that empire ultimately ends up being a losing proposition in the long run, economically and strategically, is that you tend to eventually get to a point where your imperial possessions are getting more from you, the imperial masters, than they are, you know, than you're getting back from them through the form of plunder and taxation and whatever else.
I have 1,000 customers and I take in $5,000 a piece from them, but they all cost me $6,000 a year to maintain.
Exactly.
Like that's kind of the situation you're in. And then there was another thing that happened in the 70s, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a massive drought. I think Soviet grain production reduced by like 40%, and they're a huge grain producer.
Yep.
And we ended up like basically saving their ass. Like it seems to me that had we not come to the rescue, that they may have collapsed even quicker. Of course, there might be the rationale between coming to the rescue is one, you help people and they need help, and two, like a dying beast can be really dangerous, and maybe that would have been an excuse to provoke a war. So, but how did that factor? Because that's not the only time a drought has enabled collapse. Like when you look at the Egyptian Empire collapsing, there was a massive drought that was corollary to that. The Roman Empire, for all of the valuing of money and all, there was also a massive drought that, again, in a lot of it was in the Middle East where grains were coming from, that precipitated and added to. It wasn't the cause of it, it added to. It kind of dogpiled on top of the reasons for the Roman Empire collapsing. As I've done more and more research about ancient civilizations here in North and South America pre-Columbus, there's over and over these examples of La Nina and El Nino patterns and seeing these entire empires collapse because the rain doesn't come. And so there had to be something, because the 70s were an acceleration point, and it also has that inflection point of the drought.
Yeah. When you see declining empires, you know, taken down by what we would consider sort of like natural disasters or ecological changes or whatever, to me, the way to think about it is that empires that are, or just political units in general, whether they're an empire or not, if they are flexible and resilient and anti-fragile, they're more likely to be able to adapt to things like, you know, ecological changes and catastrophes and natural disasters. And empires that are decadent, have been declining for a while, are extremely corrupt, and, you know, their elites, their oligarchs are extremely corrupt and incompetent, and the system is, like, very rigid and centrally controlled. Well, that means it's very fragile. And so then along comes, you know, whatever, anything from an earthquake to a climate shift to a volcano or, you know, whatever. And that can, it's sort of like the empire is already fragile and shaky, and then a natural disaster that the system might have been able to weather and bounce back from in previous eras comes along, only the system now is so fragile and screwed up that it's not able to bounce back, or it's not able to, you know, handle the problem in such a way that it causes the loss of political legitimacy in the eyes of a lot of the people. Because this has always been something from ancient times to today. One consistent thing is that rulers will often have as part of their justification for why they're in charge that they're going to make you prosperous and you know, comfortable. So in the days of the pharaohs, this took the form of, hey, you need to obey the pharaoh and pay taxes to him and do what he says, because he's got the hotline to the gods, because he is a god. And so he makes sure that the Nile floods like clockwork every year to water your crops. You know, he makes sure that the Nile floods enough that your crops do well, but not so much.
Does it, right? And then when it doesn't happen,
Yeah. Then you live by the sword, die by the sword, right? Then the emperor who's been saying, support me because I make the crops grow, has a real problem of the crops ain't growing, you know? And then you're likely to end up with like civil war and maybe a dynasty getting overthrown. And the modern version of that is more technocratic, but it's still the same basic idea. Hey, vote for me for president because I'll make the economy good.
Well, and there seems to be like another historical overlap there. Again, back to what went on. Like what went on in North and South America before we got here, they could make countless miniseries and drama that would be akin to anything that went on in Greek or Roman or Chinese history. Like it's unbelievable what happened here. But even on a smaller scale, like there was a town called Cahokia on the Mississippi River. It wasn't really on them. It was near the Mississippi. And when they built this town, they redirected an entire stream that was a tributary that ran into the Mississippi to run through the town because now we have water. And once you do that, there's consequences. But this town grew huge. It was really a city. And eventually it all fell apart. But what happened was when it started to fall apart, there was all the resources they needed right there. They had the knowledge. They knew what to do. They could have done some things to fix it. Instead, they like increased the size of the palisades, right, for the elite to say, ooh, look how great we are, like holding on to that decadence. And the whole thing fell apart. And over you see this here, over in Europe, Asia, these empires reach this state. They actually do, like you were alluding to there, have what they need. But instead of seeing to the problems, they see to their comfort and they see to their vassals. And eventually the people that are supposed to be being taken care of say, oh, you're a god, let's test that. Because I remember another one I read about, like some of Columbus's guys that were left in the West Indies, right? Like eventually they thought these guys were gods, but then they're like, let's hold their head underwater for a little while and see if they real. Oh, look at that. I don't think this guy is a god. Oh, shit. Now, like, so whether it's actual belief that they're deities like we had in the ancient past, or this belief that they're somehow special, they can fix everything, we need them. Either way, when that confidence dies and people are done, we always outnumber them, I guess. And sooner or later, there's a problem. Because another thing this makes me think of, CJ, this is one of the weirdest conversations I ever had. I had a girl cut my hair. It would have been late 90s, blonde chick, deep, thick Russian accent. And I'm like, so are you from Russia? Yeah. And she tells me her story, how she got to the United States and all. And I said, well, you have big changes over there. And she goes, and this is the way she put it. And this was crazy to me. She put it this melancholy, I guess, or bluntly. She goes, so we had socialism for a long time and that didn't work. So we figured we would try capitalism. I'm like, what? Like that was the rationale in switching the way that they voted, what they supported, what they wanted. We tried this. It didn't work. So we're going to try something else. It was that simple.
Yeah. Understatement of the century.
Yeah. Yeah. It did have like a crescendo in the 80s though.
Yeah.
Is there something that really triggered that? Was it the spending? Was it all of these things? Was there anything you put your finger on, one or two things, and say, this is why that was the moment that it all.
Yeah, I think it was like a cluster storm of multiple things coming together at the same time. So oil prices start to, you know, collapse pretty significantly over the course of the 80s. And so that took away the artificial stimulus, the artificial shot in the arm to the Soviet economy. You know, one of the things that it allowed them to do was to accumulate U.S. dollars that they could then use, you know, to buy other things around the world with. But now oil prices are collapsing, so that hurt them very badly. And then, you know, the years that the Soviets were in Afghanistan were 79 to 89. So they were in there a lot less than America was in there. Like, you know, as slow as the Soviets were to realize, like, this isn't going to work, we should get out of here, it took the Americans twice as long to realize that, like, we're not going to be able to remake Afghanistan into our preferred image. But, you know, in a move sort of, I guess, of hubris at the end of the 70s, they decided to invade to try and, you know, save a communist government in Afghanistan. And it just turned into a big mess. And, you know, as we know, Charlie Wilson's War is a very warped propagandistic movie in a lot of ways. But, you know, the basic idea that American intelligence helped to, you know, arm the Mujahideen and whatever is true. Now, some of those guys were later Al-Qaeda. You know, we don't want to talk about that.
Laden and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't want to talk about that, though.
Yeah. Next down the Obama name.
Yeah. And that the Afghanistan war, it really was, you know, the Soviet Vietnam. And even though their society had like less freedom of speech and political freedom than we do, there still was like huge numbers of the population that after a while were really getting angry about the war, you know, as they were losing their sons who were drafted off to go die in Afghanistan. And, you know, not even to speak of all the resources and wealth they wasted in that proxy war. So there's that. Then there's, you know, Brezhnev dies, and like you said, there were, two or three Soviet leaders after him in rapid succession. I always forget there was
three. If I remember the movie I just watched right, it was like, this guy comes in, he coughs, like the way they did in the movie, like the dude sits down at the desk, he starts coughing and shit, and then it's like the next guy's there. They made it kind of funny in the movie.
Yeah,
I think it was three.
Yeah, there was Andropov, and then there was, I guess, one or two other guys that were, you know, each in office for less than a year apiece.
Yes.
And leading to the famous Reagan joke, right? How can I negotiate with the Russians if they keep dying on me?
Yeah.
So that probably made the system, you know, even more just kind of inept and corrupt and fragile, that you've got, you know, leaders who are often elderly, senile, not even all there. And then at the same time, you've got building up things, a lot of which went back to the 70s and in some cases even to the 60s, of unrest amongst non-Russian parts of the empire. And some of this was in some of the parts of the Soviet Union that were, you know, not Russian historically and that are not Russian again today, like the Baltic states, for example. But a lot of it was also taking place in the Warsaw Pact states, too. So probably the two most famous kind of like dissident movements against communism were the Czech movement, you know, centered around Charter 77 and people like Václav Havel. And the Czech anti-communists of the 70s and 80s, I find fascinating for a variety of reasons, partly because they sort of had like a worked out philosophy of how they were going to oppose the communist system. And it was very unorthodox. They were big on this idea of parallel institutions and the parallel society. A lot of the that language of, you know, oh, we need to just have parallel structures and a parallel society, a lot of that really comes from the Czech dissidents, believe it or not. And, you know, they were like, look, we don't want to confront the communist system head on. In Czechoslovakia, they had tried that in 1968, and the Soviets just sent in the tanks and crushed it. So you know what, we're not going to try and fight them head on. That would be stupid. They'll just wipe us out again, but let's just kind of like quietly, in sort of an underground way, kind of quietly build our own, you know, indie kind of black and gray market things of doing, like little underground things, like, you know, technically illegal underground presses to publish forbidden books and things and, you know, stuff like that. We're going to sponsor concerts by dissident bands that we know the government doesn't like. and we're just going to build our own little society, quietly under the nose. Václav Havel called the Soviet system at that time post-totalitarian. And it's really interesting because when he describes what the post-totalitarian system is and what he means by that, it actually is very reminiscent of where the American system is today in a lot of ways, where it's like authoritarian, and there's a lot of surveillance, and there's a lot of like attempts to enforce political orthodoxies. And yet at the same time, the system is so like ossified and decadent and corrosive that, it's not super apt. It's kind of inept, if that makes sense. So you've got them. And another thing I find interesting about the Czech dissidents is that they were mostly like artists and intellectuals, which it's relatively rare for people like that to pull off a successful political revolution. But in the case of the Czechoslovakians, they did it. It was a bunch of playwrights and poets and, you know, novelists and whatever like that. But they actually accomplished something for real. And then by contrast, you have a very different thing in the case of Poland, where you've got the Solidarity movement led by Lech Walesa, who that's another very interesting one, where he's like a regular blue collar factory worker kind of a dude. He's not any kind of an intellectual or a political leader. He's like a regular guy, but he ends up almost kind of like unintentionally becoming the figurehead of this independent non-communist labor union that gets going in Poland. And it really just starts off with basic bread and butter kind of labor union issues, like we'd like to have better pay, we'd like to have better conditions, we'd like, you know, simple things like this. And the communist view of labor unions was, we love labor unions in Western countries and we'll covertly sponsor them because that's an important part of the communist revolution.
Yeah.
But here,
we don't have a lot of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know,
we're
because,
already where we want them to take, so we don't. Now they're annoying. They're in the way, right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, exactly. We already are the workers' paradise. Therefore, anyone who's claiming to be a labor union trying to, you know, make things better for the workers must be, you know, a fascist Western infiltrator. You know, must be someone looking to betray a revolution. Because by definition, we are the workers' paradise. It's the same logic they used, by the way, in the Soviet Union to weaponize psychology, where for quite a while, you could actually end up in like a lunatic asylum type facility if you were too much of a political dissident. And this was a way that they were able to medicalize suppressing dissidents rather than doing it the way Stalin did. They tried to make it seem more humane and reasonable.
We made it perfect, so if you're not happy, you must have mental problems.
Exactly. There were diagnoses in Soviet psychology manuals that were things along the lines of, you know, you could get diagnosed as denying the achievements of communism. Like, that's actually something your psychiatrist could, like, institutionalize you, Baker Act you for, so to speak.
More pop culture reference, Goldmember, right? There is no policing you.
Yeah. So a lot of these dissidents, both inside and in the Warsaw Pact states, you know, they started building bigger and bigger movements of people that were, you know, organizing for nonviolent political resistance and setting up parallel alternative institutions, all these sorts of things, and getting a lot of international attention and support. You know, people around the world were rooting for Lech Walesa and Václav Havel and people like that. And then a big boost, of course, also came when, I forget if it was late 70s or early 80s, but when the Catholic Church got John Paul II as Pope, that was another factor that, you know, I think kind of sped up the decline of the Soviet Union because it was able to focus so much international attention. You know, John Paul II being a Polish anti-communist Pope who was very outspoken in his anti-communism. And that added fuel to the anti-communist movements in Poland. And when John Paul II visited Poland and you know, preached there, I forget what year it was that he first did that. That was huge. Mm-hmm. That was huge because communism, like any political ideology that tends towards you know, authoritarianism and coerced conformity and whatever. Communism relies on most regular people believing that even if they've figured out the emperor has no clothes, everyone else around them still thinks the emperor has great clothes. So it relies on regular people who kind of feel like this system seems unfair. This system seems wrong. This system seems corrupt. This system doesn't do a very good job of taking care of my life. It relies on you thinking that you're alone in thinking that, and that everybody else around you, that you're walking around in the streets, every other, you know, average Ivan or average Lek or whatever, they're all in on it. They're all like, oh yeah, this is great. Communism is working for me. I'm happy. And you think you're like a lone weirdo who has doubts about the system. But then in comes the Pope.
Sounds very familiar to modern life in America, and just it's not communism. It's basically intellectual Marxism is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah, and corporatist
and a fascist economic system. We have like the unholy matrimony of fascism and Marxism here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So you know the communist government in Poland, their point of view was like the Polish people support communism. They're not a bunch of backwards anti-revolutionaries supporting the frickin' Catholic Church and the Pope. This is just, you know, a bunch of propaganda. But then the Pope came in and preached, and like literally every single person in Warsaw came out to see him preach. And there's like millions of people in the streets. It was like the biggest thing ever. And the fact that everybody was coming out of their houses and, you know, looking around, this is why big demonstrations still matter. This is why it still matters to have, like, you know, a million people show up to a demonstration against a war or in favor of some political reform or whatever. Because there is something powerful. It does send a kind of, like, you know, implied threat to the establishment of, like, hey, we could get a million people in the streets because they're angry about this policy you're doing, so maybe you might want to back off. It does that, too, but also for the people themselves who are involved in the demonstration or the gathering in the streets or whatever, it causes them to look around and go, holy shit, I thought I was alone. I thought everybody else around me in Warsaw was still believing in communism, was all in on the system, and I was a weirdo for doubting it, and I had to keep my opinions to myself if I knew what was good for me. Well, shit, turns out that like every single one of my neighbors would rather hear the Pope than hear the communist government tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. And so it was very powerful. And, you know, yeah, it also mattered that you had Reagan taking a harder line against communism than the presidents right before him, and amping up the arms race, and, you know, a lot of other Western leaders kind of, you know, standing strong with him on that, Thatcher, people like that, blanking on the West German chancellor at the time. His name, was it Helmut Kohl, one of those guys? So, yeah, you had a bunch of factors come together, and then you have this bizarre thing, which I think is this like black swan that is the main reason we can point to for why the collapse of the Soviet Empire didn't turn into an absolute bloodbath or even, you know, World War III or something. And that is Gorbachev comes to power in the mid 80s, comes in as the general secretary of the party. And I still don't have a good explanation as to how somebody like Gorbachev managed to get to the top of the Kremlin political structure, because the Kremlin under communism was very much like a Game of Thrones type of deal.
Do you think that maybe, CJ, with all these dudes dying, like we all think they died because they drank and smoked too much, which is probably true, but did maybe people that were in line for it think somebody's like taking them out, and if I take the job, like I don't know about you, but if I was a guy in Rome near the top of the hierarchy and there's like you're in the running for the new emperor, there's a whole bunch of periods of time in there, I don't want that. No. I'll stay over here and, you know, be a philosophizer or something. Like, you think maybe that he got there because other people didn't, like, I don't want to be in charge right now?
It's possible. I mean, it's possible that some of the other guys, you know, who might have been potentially in line might have maybe realized that the system was, you know, getting towards the end. Maybe. But
nobody wanted the hot potato at the end of the game or something. I mean,
yeah, that's possible. And maybe that's why the establishment is, you know, throwing in the towel a little bit on Kamala, so that Trump is left holding the bag of the next few years, which are probably not going to be great no matter what he does.
Yeah.
But yeah, the fact that Gorbachev came in and like, you know, here's a young guy. I think he was only in his 40s or early 50s when he came to power. And not only that, but like, he was a decent dude. Like, I really believe after really reading a lot about him and doing tons of research on this topic over many years, I really do believe that at the end of the day, Gorbachev was a decent dude. Like, he believed some stuff that was, you know, in error. Like, he still believed that communism could be salvaged and fixed and reformed and made to work better and whatever. Okay, fine. You know, we know he's wrong about that. But he was a decent dude in the sense that, like, he really didn't have the stomach for, you know, using force to crush demonstrations and, you know, slaughtering protesters and, you know, all these sorts of things. He, you know, wanted to wrap up the war in Afghanistan, and ultimately did. And he, you know, wanted to try to hold the system together and reform it. And his reforms, ironically, probably ended up speeding up the decline. But, you know, he had glasnost, which was openness, which meant, you know, we're going to have a lot more freedom of speech and expression, and you can actually criticize the government and whatever. And his view was like, well, yeah, if we're going to reform communism and make it work better, people need to be free to speak their minds so that we, the you know, the politicians running it, get accurate feedback on what the problems of the system are. The problem is, if you let people who have been repressed for a long time under an unhappy system finally speak their mind, once they realize you're serious, you know, initially they're going to be like, wait a minute, is this a ruse? Is this just like a Stalin move where you're going to tell us we can speak freely? And then meanwhile, while we're speaking freely, you're writing down all of our names to come throw us in the gulag later. Once they realized he was serious about, you know, free expression, people were like, okay, we're going to criticize everything. And it, you know, quickly went beyond what he ever, I think, intended or anticipated. And then he had perestroika, which was restructuring, which was, you know, some economic reform, some decentralization of certain parts of the economy and whatever, but still trying to keep it overall, you know, still kind of a socialist system. And that didn't work. A lot of those things were the sorts of reforms that, like, they make the communist system work less well without giving you a full market system, which would work a lot better, so to speak. It's like neither fish nor fowl kind of a reform. And then other things he did that just made himself unpopular in Russia a lot. Like, he did try to have alcohol prohibition for a while because the drinking problems in Russia were so bad in the 70s and 80s, and that made him very unpopular.
Yeah, I'll do it. That doesn't work out.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, you know, he was vigorously trying to pursue arms control with the United States because he was having a hard time matching Reagan's defense spending and all that, and so was very serious about trying to reduce nuclear arms.
And they also believed that SDI was a thing.
Yeah.
Like, we totally sold them on this thing that didn't even exist.
Yeah. 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 It's fascinating, too, just sort of a side thing. In the late 70s, early 80s, we can now see, with access to, like, behind the scenes information, late 70s, early 80s, the Soviet system was in serious trouble. Lots of indicators of this. But lots of Americans at the time had the opposite view. They thought, you know, the Soviet system is getting stronger than ever and is on the march, you know. Part of the reason for this perception in America was neocon propaganda. The neocons really started to have an influence on this stuff in the 70s. It was under, I believe, Gerald Ford, that something got created within the CIA that was called Team B. So there were a lot of CIA, like, long-term, you know, Soviet experts who were, like, serious professionals trying to relay accurate information to the president. And some of them were like, hey, wait a minute. Underneath the surface, there are all these signs that the Soviet system is in real trouble. Here's all these indications that their military is kind of a paper tiger. Yeah, on paper, it's huge. But in reality, a lot of their troops are in terrible condition. They're not really, you know, fit to fight very well. Their equipment is, you know, not properly maintained, won't work if it comes to it. And these guys were kind of, you know, starting to say, like, hey, we think the Soviets are really on the decline right now. The neocons didn't want that because the neocons wanted to have more defense spending all the time, like they always do. And so Team B came in the 70s, and Team B was a whole bunch of neocons, many of whom didn't even really have, like, deep, you know, experience with studying the Soviet system and everything. And they basically were given the job of, like, come up with the worst case possible interpretation of intelligence. In other words, whatever intelligence we give you, as far as just, like, specific data points of things going on, interpret it in the scariest possible light.
Okay.
And so there was one, and that's what they did. That's what these neocons did. And then the president would just like choose to believe them instead of believing the long, you know, the longstanding professionals in the CIA who were actually trying to do some honest intelligence for once. So there would be things like, you know, the regular guys, the regular intelligence guys would be like, hey, we have no evidence that the Soviets are developing a next generation of nuclear subs that are super, super stealthy and whatever. There's just no evidence for that. Team B would come in and go, look, it's
what
true.
What they could be.
Yeah.
What they could be.
we think that what they're actually doing is developing stealth submarines that are so high tech and so stealthy that we can't detect them at all.
I see.
And so in reality, the complete absence of evidence.
The fact that we don't know they exist proves they do exist.
The absence of evidence just proves how slick and sneaky they are with this stuff, right?
I see.
So, yeah, a lot of that was fueling this perception, especially on the American Republican side, but even on the Democrat side, too, this perception that, like, oh, no, they are this, you know, invulnerable superpower. Hmm. But, you know, I give a lot of credit to Gorbachev because it's possible. It's possible that had a much more ruthless, bloodthirsty Stalin kind of a guy been in charge in the 80s, he might have been willing to just do whatever it took to crush all of the resistance and opposition, both in the Soviet Union and in the Warsaw Pact states, and might have been able to do it. You know, if a Stalin type figure had been willing to just do whatever it took to crush all dissidents and opposition, maybe could have pulled it off with enough just ruthlessness. And maybe, you know, might have caused the system to hang together for another generation just by brute force. But Gorbachev didn't have that, you know, character. He was actually a decent guy who didn't want to slaughter people like that. And so ultimately, though, you know, he wanted to save the system, when it became clear that the system wasn't savable, he kind of acquiesced to the system falling apart and, you know, took the troops out of Afghanistan, refused to use brute force to try and hold on to the Warsaw Pact states, and, you know, even let some parts of the Soviet Union itself go their own way, too. So, you know, and he refused also to back up Moscow's sock puppets in the satellite states. So when, like, the communist governments of Poland would be, like, cabling back to Moscow saying, hey, we got all these, you know, demonstrations and all this resistance. If you guys in Moscow don't send in the tanks soon, we might not be able to hold on to power here. And Gorbachev ultimately was like, well, I'm not sending in the tanks this time. You know, you guys have to figure it out. And ultimately, most of those rulers decided, well, you know, for my
I'm not doing it either, right?
Like, yeah. I mean, there was the lone exception, which is a very interesting one, of Ceausescu in Romania, where in Romania was always a weird one where they were like,
Romania's been weird, period. Like, oh, yeah, Romania has been weird since the dawn of Romania. Like,
true.
Yeah.
And they had been for a while, like, a little bit more independent than some of the other Warsaw Pact states. And you know, Ceausescu was much more of like an old school Stalin, like crazy.
Yeah.
Almost like a North Korean style dictator in a lot of ways. And so he tried to hang on and ultimately ended up, he and his crazy wife, ended up getting lined up against a wall and shot. By some of their own soldiers after kind of a show trial.
Which is exactly why I was going to say I think most of the other ones decided to let it go, because they didn't want to get lined up on a wall or, you know, in Romania you could end up on a big pike. Like, I mean, right? Like, they kind of invented that, I think, you know?
Yeah. And I got to say, like, I just love, I mean, I guess it's kind of dark and morbid and whatever, but man, I do love the story and like the images and the video clips of Ceausescu and his wife getting arrested and tried by their own, you know, people after they ordered their own soldiers and police to go shoot demonstrators, and the soldiers and police were like, nope.
No,
we're not shooting those demonstrators. That. We're pointing our guns at you, dear
Lord.
Yeah. It's just one of those beautiful moments, you know, and someone as monstrous as Ceausescu, like, I don't shed a tear when he and his wife get lined up against the wall.
None.
You know, I'm not advocating violence, but let's just say certain figures within the American establishment.
There's four people it could happen to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if unfortunate things were to happen to them, I would not shed any tears or lose any sleep and would feel at least somewhat of a sense of, you know, satisfaction You got what you deserved.
What you're hitting on now, though, is something I want to talk about, and that is the difference of experiencing this collapse from inside, depending on where you were. We think of the Soviet Union as this big monstrosity that used to be, you know, in Europe and Asia, and that's kind of it. But like you mentioned, it was the Warsaw Pact states, you know, like Poland and what have you. They weren't part of the Soviet Union. East Germany wasn't part of it. It was, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
But then, like, we have much bigger, longer tentacles reached way further out than the Soviet Union ever did. But that's a pretty long one. It's Cuba. Like, if you were in Cuba when the Soviet Union fell apart, it was not a non-event.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't the same, like, if you were in Cuba or you were in Puerto Rico. It was a very different experience. So what were maybe some of these different places like as this their whole world was falling apart? And many of them may have been like, yes, but this sucks, right? Yeah. I think that's something people don't realize. Like, you can really want to get rid of a system of government, but it doesn't mean the transition will be smooth, even if they just give up and let it go.
Yeah. Yeah, overall, on average, you know, it varies a little bit from country to country, but overall, I think it's fair to say that the Warsaw Pact states did the best coming out of the end of communism. And partly this is because those countries were the wealthiest communist countries in general. You know, East Germany was way poorer per capita than West Germany, but it was also way richer per capita than, like, the rest of the communist world. And to a lesser extent, the same is true of, you know, Poland, Czechoslovakia, all these places. And then these people, not only did these countries also have, in general, a little bit higher standard of living than a lot of the rest of the communist world, but they had the most, like, fully formed dissident movements, which could then be the seeds of new governments. So, you know, in the case of Poland, like, the first fair democratic elections Poland has when communism is, you know, falling there, the Solidarity Movement, Lech Walesa's labor union, which had morphed into a political party, they won. And so you had this political movement that had been being built for, like, over a decade that was now, you know, coming in as the alternative to communism to, like, start a new government. And the same thing was true of Václav Havel's movement in Czechoslovakia and similar things in most of the Warsaw Pact states. And then they also had the fact that these people had a very strong sense of nationalism and in many cases also of, like, cultural and religious identity. And this was able to kind of substitute for communist ideology as, like, a unifying, you know, force for the people of that society and their civil religion. Meanwhile, you know, Cuba did very badly because they had gotten so dependent on Soviet welfare to kind of keep them economically on life support. And the same thing was true in a lot of ways in North Korea, too. North Korea got much worse in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union because suddenly they weren't getting, you know, imperial welfare from Moscow. So, you know, in those places, it was pretty bad. In the Warsaw Pact, it was relatively good, not to say it was always easy or smooth. In the Soviet Union itself, it depended on where you were. The Baltic states sort of fared similarly, as far as I'm aware, to the Warsaw Pact states, where they had a relatively easier transition, you know, sort of bounced back. Because as bad of a system as communism is, when it is your economy, when that falls apart, like, there's going to be a painful transition. Whether you end up going to, you know, a viable market system or something else, there's still going to be a painful transition period. Because as screwed up as communism is, if that's what you're used to being your economy for, like, 80 years and suddenly it's gone, you know, people have to figure out, like, how to do things, and it doesn't always go smoothly. In Russia itself, there was some of the worst corruption and poverty and some of the worst, like, societal collapse and cultural decline, you know, life expectancy fell off a cliff, alcoholism, which was already bad, you know, skyrocketed in the aftermath of the fall of communism. And then, you know, both in and around Russia and some of the former Soviet and Warsaw Pact states, where you often saw the most problems, and in some places still to this day, is where there are ethnic issues, where there are different ethnic groups mixed together that don't get along with each other, and where the borders on the ground don't really reflect the demographics on the ground for various reasons. And this is always a problem with empires because empires, by definition, are multi-ethnic. It's where you've got, you know, one government ruling over a widespread, far-flung collection of territories, which always includes, you know, a lot of different ethnic groups and religious and language groups and everything like that. And so once an imperial government is in charge, very often they will move people around within the empire in various ways, sometimes just forcibly moving them, sometimes incentivizing certain ethnic groups to move to certain places.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, usually political and economic rationales for this. It's often part of a divide and rule strategy. So, you know, this often amounts to basically colonization. So I'll point to one example that's very timely and relevant to today. Ukraine. Okay. Ukraine is a country where there is an ethnic group called Ukrainians with a language called Ukrainian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they consider themselves distinct from the Russians ethnically, in terms of language, et cetera. Right. But starting with the Tsar, you know, a lot of the things about the Soviet Union, really started under the Tsar and were just continued by the Soviets, like moving different ethnic groups around and colonizing certain parts of the country with ethnic groups that hadn't been there before. So there had been some Russian colonization in Ukraine under the Tsars going back a long time. But during the Soviet system, there was a real concerted effort to move ethnic Russians into certain parts of Ukraine for sort of political and economic strategic reasons. And so this is how you ended up with a very large number of ethnic Russians in especially eastern Ukraine. And, you know, when you add to that the fact that Crimea had been attached to Ukraine by Khrushchev, mm-hmm, back in the 50s, even though historically Crimea had been part of Russia for a long time. But it didn't matter when Khrushchev did that, when Khrushchev said, Crimea is now part of Ukraine, not part of Russia. From his perspective, it didn't really matter. It was just sort of like a symbolic gesture to Ukraine.
He did it because he wanted to retire in Ukraine and still be it'd be Ukraine. He was from Ukraine.
Yeah.
He was a Ukrainian. He wanted to retire in Crimea, but he wanted it to be Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's why he did it. Well, yeah, that's one of the reasons. Because the other thing that – and Soviets did this a lot was they would take in a republic, one of these republics like Ukraine or like Lithuania, but – move the eastern boundary into Russia proper to make sure there were a certain number of ethnic Russians in this new semi-autonomous, because their republics were kind of like our states. They had, mm-hmm, certain autonomy, and you wanted a balancing force in there. So you put your guys in by this. And that's a big part of the problem we have with Ukraine right now, because they did that both in, well, Crimea was already that way. The whole, mm-hmm, thing was Russia. And then this whole Luhansk and Donetsk, this whole region was actually Russia. That's why we have these issues today.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of the reasons. I wouldn't say it's the only reason.
Yeah, and that's a super common problem of empires is, you know, people running an empire will engage in these little, like, internal colonizations and things.
Yeah.
And they'll do it for various reasons. It's usually a combination of political and economic factors. And usually also is at least partly a divide and rule strategy, because it's easier to control a population if the population is bitterly divided into different factions. So, you can see it in the aftermath of most empires. You can see spots where this happens. You know, why is Yugoslavia, why has that been such a powder keg for a while in the aftermath of the collapse of communism? Well, it's because you had all these ethnic groups that had been mixed together by, you know, by the Austrian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, other powers in that neighborhood. And then once those empires fall, then you end up with this, you know, synthetic state called Yugoslavia. But Yugoslavia is not like an ethnicity. It's a nation, but it's not really like a organic, you know, ethno nation in a way. It's a whole bunch of different language and religious and cultural groups that don't all like each other. And so once they no longer have like the common, an empire ruling over all of them and kind of keeping them from fighting each other constantly, now it's open season. And so that's a lot of, you know, what's been going on in Ukraine and some other areas of the former Soviet Union where, you know, in Ukraine, yeah, it's like, the eastern half of the country is full of Russians. And, you know, a lot of them big majorities of them actually would rather be part of Russia than be a, you know, discriminated against minority within Ukraine. And, you know, flip side, a lot of Ukrainians see the, you know, ethnic Russian people living in Ukraine as like not being Ukrainian. They see them as, you know, at the very least of suspect loyalty. And kind of, you know, it's mutually justifying sort of thing where the Ukrainians don't trust, the Russians, because they think their loyalties are to Russia, and the Russians, you know, their loyalties are to Russia, and not always, you know, unjustifiably. In some cases, it's because the Ukrainians aren't treating them very well. So it turns into a big hornet's nest. It is kind of interesting, though, to think about in the American Empire, the mass influx of illegal immigrants, and I still find it bizarre that the propaganda machine is telling us that we have to call them migrants, which is weird. Like, we're talking about birds who are here temporarily for the...
Yeah, migrants go and come back, right? Migration is a two-way street. It's not a one-way destination.
Yeah. These are not people who are coming north for the summer and then are going to be headed back down south for the winter.
They're not snowboarding or reverse snowboarding here.
Yeah. But, you know, I think at least part of the rationale for why the establishment seems so hell-bent on doing this is that same kind of idea of, you know, importing a bunch of people into places where they haven't been before, where they are, you know, ethnically and linguistically separate from the people that already live there. And number one, that creates all kinds of tensions and conflicts that the government then can come in to mediate, quote unquote, and suppress if there's violence. But just in general, it makes it easier to manage people. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book, divide and rule. And so I think part of what's driving this, you know, crazy uncontrolled immigration into the U.S. right now is sort of like the same strategy as when Moscow was trying to, you know, colonize tons of ethnic Russians into Ukraine. It's a similar sort of strategy. It's a political strategy of control.
Can you talk about, like, you know, you mentioned Ukraine. We have some pretty hot conflict there right now. But overall, NATO-Russia relations, I would define the word toxic, I think, would be the way that I would describe this. And this has been the case since the Soviet Union fall. Like, we can completely, like, if we're willing to take the establishment on its face, accept why that was the case until the 1980s, through the 1980s, right? We formed NATO to counteract the Warsaw Pact, and they formed the Warsaw Pact to carry, well, obviously we're supposed to say, it falls apart. And Russia pretty much puts their hat in their hand and says, hey, we want to get along. And the collective response from the West is pretty much double middle fingers and go screw yourself. And is it just because they want an enemy? I mean, why is that? Because, I mean, Putin said during his interview with Tucker that he literally told Clinton he wanted to join NATO and was told to F off summarily. Like, why is that the case?
Yeah. It's such a tragedy. The fact that the U.S. and victorious NATO allies, victorious in the Cold War, the fact that they couldn't handle victory in like a generous, you know, magnanimous sort of way, really. It is now verified. For a long time, establishment cheerleaders would deny this. It's now verified that Secretary of State, what's his name, James Baker, made a promise to the Russians as the Soviet Empire was falling apart and the, you know, Berlin Wall's coming down and the satellite states and the Warsaw Pact are breaking free. There was this question of what's going to happen with Germany. And the Russians were understandably very, like, squeamish about Germany reuniting. Yeah. And Americans might not understand why, but you have to understand in both World War I and World War II, Russia was invaded by Germany and lost millions and millions of people. Okay. By the way, there's not been a single war so far in which America has lost a million men.
Yeah.
It still hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Even the American Civil War didn't reach a million dead.
Well, like, and another thing to realize about this, I think this is important for people to understand. If you go back and you look at the NATO chiefs of the 60s and 70s, almost all of them were former Nazis. I dropped that on social media last week. I'm like, no, that's not. Go look. Take 10 minutes and go look it up. Take 10 minutes to go look it up. So you've got this nation that's been providing the NATO chiefs, the you know, our Germany anyway, and many of them that had lineage right back to service in World War II, running fucking NATO. I would be a little concerned, too, if I was Russia.
Yeah, Operation Paperclip, which was like the last big operation carried out by the OSS, the American, you know, original CIA during World War II. Operation Paperclip, most people, if they've heard of it, they know, you know, that it saved a bunch of rocket scientists.
Yeah, we brought
from
them all
facing
here.
Justice. Yeah, Wernher von Braun and all those guys. Which is true, but then also they saved a lot of German intelligence guys. Nazi intelligence guys, because the rationale was, and a lot of these guys, they were like, you know, Gestapo and SS bigwigs, who were certainly guilty of many horrible things.
And for all the talk of Nuremberg, what do we execute, like 11 of them?
Yeah,
it was 11 people got executed at Nuremberg.
Yeah, it was not nearly as many as should have deserved it.
Yeah,
but yeah, a lot of the guys saved under Paperclip were high up Nazi intelligence operatives, and the rationale was, well, they've already been, you know, spying and operating against the Soviets for years, so, you know, let's just adopt them, and they'll bring all their knowledge and skills with them to come work for our team against the Soviets now. So, you know, the Russians were understandably squeamish about Germany reuniting in light of what happened to them twice during the 20th century, and the Americans assuaged their fear by saying, oh, don't worry. We make you a solemn pinky swear promise that if you let Germany, you know, reunify under a Western style democratic government, we promise up, down, and sideways, we will not expand NATO one inch east of Germany. And that promise didn't last very long. It was within just a few years, a little bit later in the 90s, that under Bill Clinton, the U.S. started adding Warsaw Pact states to NATO, and then, you know, kept going from there, and eventually started adding even former Soviet states that had broken away, like the Baltic states and Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. And these were places that during the Cold War were like legally part of the Soviet Union. They weren't even satellite states of the Soviet Union. They were part of the Soviet Union, like legally, in the same way that an American state is part of the U.S. And now they're added to NATO. And, you know, the Russian leaders really started to get weirded out by this, especially as it continued and started going further and further and further east. There are some interesting computer animated, like, time-lapse maps that you can find out there that show NATO expansion over the years since, like, 1990. And you just watch. It just add another piece, marching further and further and further east towards Russia, a country which still has the largest stockpile of nukes in the world, and a country with a very long history of being paranoid about being invaded from the West. Like, not just that the Germans...
With good reason!
Yeah.
Right, with good reason. Is it really paranoia if you're right? I don't know if it's paranoia. It might be more attentiveness or alert.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes back even further than the two German invasions of the 20th century in World War I and World War II. Napoleon. Napoleon had invaded Russia from the West and ultimately got defeated, but he
I was saying, it happens a lot, and it always seems like it was a bad idea, right? Like, it never tends to work out.
Yeah, I mean, the Russians, you know, eventually end up booting out whoever invades them, but it's usually really costly for them. Like, it usually results in them losing millions of lives and, you know, having huge amounts of resources destroyed and cities burned and whatever. And so, look, you know, you don't have to, like, think that Joseph Stalin is a good guy to understand why he would be paranoid about being invaded from the West. Like, you know, anybody who was the head of, even if Russia was like a Western style non-communist democracy in like 1940, they still would have been paranoid about, you know, threats from the West. And so, you know, you keep building up NATO until now you're like literally on their front doorstep. And Russian leaders have continued to be like, hey, please stop expanding NATO. Hey, please stop expanding NATO. And a lot of times this is accompanied by, you know, these so-called color revolutions that, anytime there's a government in a country next door to Russia that Team America doesn't like, it doesn't make, even if that government is a legit democracy, the CIA is going to go in there. George Soros sponsored NGOs are going to go in there, yeah, and they're going to overthrow it. And they're going to try and install a pro West, pro NATO government.
Have you noticed this too, CJ? Any government we disagree with is a dictatorship. Oh, yeah. Every single one, it doesn't matter how the guy gets elected, what his margins are. It doesn't matter how the government's actually run. If we disagree with them 1%, we've called Orban a freaking dictator. Hungary is as much a modern democracy as any nation in Western, in all of Europe, right? As any nation. But he's a dictator because he dares say no. What's his name? Is the dictator in Syria, even though he stands election over and over again.
Assad, yeah.
Yeah, like, he's a dictator. Wait a minute. I mean, like, do any of you assholes who keep saying that get elected by the margins this dude does?
Yeah, to the American establishment, democracy really amounts to
what we say.
You vote for the people that we approve of, and they do the policies that we and the American oligarchy approve of.
Yeah.
So
now we're doing it openly in the United States. If you don't vote for one person, you're a threat to democracy, right? Like it's like, I think another symptom of late stage empires, they start saying the quiet part out loud.
Yep.
Like, fuck it, we got to tell them what we're doing. But then we'll say, it's for your own good. It's like the husband that beats his wife and says, I only do it because I love you.
Yep.
Right? You know, I cheated on you, but I was thinking of you the whole time. I only did it because I love you. I know I beat you after I got drunk, but I only did it because I love you. Like, that's how the late-stage empires act.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, there's this saying, the empire always comes home. And I think that happens like throughout an empire's existence, but it speeds up when you're in like late stage decline. And so what I mean by that phrase, for those who aren't familiar with it, the empire always comes home, is that very often an imperial government will do things out in the provinces and in other countries and in far flung, you know, fringe territories, or, you know, it'll do things that it would never do at home. In the imperial center, in the metropolis, right? So, you know, early 1900s, the U.S. was doing nasty things in the Philippines, very authoritarian things in the Philippines that the U.S. government at that time would have never even considered trying to do at home. Because the feeling was like, oh, look, that's the other side of the world. It's these foreign people that don't look like us that seem incompetent. Legally, this is a colony, not an American state, so the Constitution doesn't fully apply. The Supreme Court actually ruled that in the so-called insular cases. And so there were much more authoritarian things being done out there than were done here. But then over time, you know, for a variety of reasons, those authoritarian things start to eventually show up being done at home. You see it also in regard to the Vietnam War, where during and for a while after the Vietnam War, there was a massive uptick in the militarization of American police. Now, why is that? Well, a big part of it is a lot of guys who, you know, go serve in the military for a while, if they then, you know, leave that career, come back, whatever. What's a very common job for ex-military guys to get into when they come home? Law enforcement. And so you've been a soldier serving in Vietnam, where, you know, when you go in to search a village, you're looking at a hostile, occupied enemy that is, you know, looking to commit acts of insurgency against you. You're paranoid about that. And you don't have to worry about respecting the constitutional rights of the people that live in My Lai or whatever. And so that's what you're used to doing. And so, of course, when you come home and then maybe go into law enforcement, that's the mindset. You're not going to have the approach of like, these are my fellow citizens and neighbors. I need to respect their rights. Yes, I might occasionally have to arrest them or hurt them or, you know, hit them with a club or shoot them in self-defense or whatever. But, you know, I need to use the least amount of force. I need to try and de-escalate as much as I can. I am, more than anything else, a peace officer. Well, if you've been serving for years in a brutal insurgency war and then you come home and become a police officer, you're going to bring that mindset with you most likely, whether you realize you're doing it or not. And just in general, people, the population at home gets gradually habituated to the government doing nasty things abroad and those things gradually coming home. You know, look at how crazy the U.S. government has been with drone assassinations in other countries. does anybody really think that if the American system continues to exist in its current form for a while to come yet, does anybody really believe that they're never going to use lethal drones here? Like, I have a hard time thinking that that's never going to be a thing. And I'm not even just talking about, like...
We already did, CJ. We just didn't do it the way we're thinking of it. War, with it being a flying drone. The guy that shot a bunch of people... And I'm not even saying they shouldn't have done it, but the dude that shot a bunch of people in Fort Worth, Texas, or Dallas, Texas, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, he was holed up in a parking garage. He was behind a car. He wasn't going anywhere. They could have talked him out. And it might have been better, because then you could get the guy and find out what went on, why it happened. They took a robot, they put a freaking shape charge on it, they drove the robot behind the car remotely, and they blew his ass up. If that's not a drone bomb, you tell me what is. And that was 5 years ago, at least. It might have been 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah. And so, you know, how long will it be? And it's these sort of things, you know. I know the boiling frog isn't true because, you know, reptiles and amphibians are cold-blooded and they thermoregulate away from as soon as they get uncomfortable. But, you know, the idea of it is true, though, in terms of, like, you gradually get people habituated to something that if you hit them with it right out of the gate, they'd be like, whoa, what the hell are you doing? This is authoritarian, you know, tyranny. But if you can just gradually desensitize it to them, maybe have some good predictive programming and lots of TV and movies, you know, hey, Jack Bauer is the good guy and he tortures people. Yeah, so maybe torture isn't so bad, you know?
And they always torture actual bad people first. They always blow up actual bad people first so that you become like, well, are you going to say we shouldn't have blown up Hitler? Because he was Hitler. I mean, of course we should have blown him up, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, yeah, obviously that's an extreme version, but you take people that... You know, 95% of people would go, yeah, I don't give a fuck that he's dead. Because, like, the dude that I just mentioned that they killed in Dallas, I do not object to his death. I just, when I look at it procedurally, go, actually, I'm surprised we haven't seen that happen more.
Yeah.
Like, because that was a legit drone strike. That's what that was.
Yeah. And, you know, at least a few times that we know of for sure, and probably other times we don't know of, Obama ordered the death of American citizens on foreign soil with a lethal drone with no trial. And, you know, basically his, what was it, Holder, his attorney general, his statement was something like, oh, yeah, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki and his teenage son, they got due process. They got due process because, you know, me and the president had a meeting where we talked about it for a few minutes. And, like, I mean, that's due process. Even, like, they could have put trial by a jury of your peers. That's due process now.
They could have put paint on it. They could have tried them in absentia, right? Like, it would have been bullshit, but they could have at least went through the motions of pretending. They didn't even bother because they knew. And this is when a government could do a thing to mitigate a thing they're going to do, and it wouldn't stop them from doing it, and they don't do it. I believe they've reached the point of not giving a fuck what you think. They either know they're going to get away with it, that nobody will really care, or the people that care won't matter enough for it to matter, so fuck it, we're just going to blow it to prove we can do it. And then there's also kind of like governments traditionally have used capital punishment more as a deterrent against dissent than actually stop crime. Look how powerful I am. With a wave of my hand, I can have you hung from the gallows or have some dude chop your head off or blow your brains out or throw you out of a building or whatever, and therefore thou shalt fear me. Right. That's and I think that's our government's getting closer and closer to that. I do want to kind of move us toward wrapping up, though, because we're at Joe Rogan level podcast hours here. Right. Like, so what can we learn? What can current day Americans and other Westerners learn from all this? And kind of if you can condense that to like a 5 minute answer, because I got like two more I want to hit.
Yeah. And I'm sorry for being such a long winded history nerd, but that's sort of my thing. I think there are a lot of things, that are parallel or similar enough that it gives us at least possible scenarios of how certain things might play out, as the American empire continues to decline. And so, I mean, just think about all the parallels. Like, on the one hand, you might say, oh, it's so different. You know, that was a communist system or a capitalist system. Well, I mean, it was a socialist oligarchy. We're a corporatist oligarchy. I don't know if it's as different as you think it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, just the idea that you've got this superpower, you know, this country that came out of World War II as one of the big winners, that, you know, one of the two quote-unquote superpowers of the 20th century, now the other superpower is sort of following the same path that the Soviets went down first. Somebody, I forget who, somebody put it like this. They said, the Soviets and the Americans both lost the Cold War. It's just the Soviets lost it first, and the Americans are still in the process of losing it. So, in other words, this idea that, like, imperialism is an unsustainable project overall. But, you know, you've got a country that its own citizens are suffering economically, struggling to make ends meet, while the rulers are living in the lap of luxury, clearly corrupt and decadent, and are lavishing resources as the population struggles to make ends meet. They're continuing to lavish resources on the military-industrial complex and continuing to send money abroad. I mean, you know, in the 80s, Russia was still sending money to Cuba to subsidize them. Well, here we are today. The U.S. government has apparently not much money to send up to North Carolina to help the people hit by that hurricane. But, man, do they have endless amounts of dough for Israel and Ukraine, don't they? So, you know, you've also got in the American system, you've got ethnic tension and unrest. And part of this is, you know, being stoked by wokeist ideology. Part of it's being stoked by weaponized immigration and importing, you know, millions of people without limits who you know, don't smoothly fit into the existing population. So you've got ethnic tensions. You've got just in general the volatile situation of a government with lots of nukes and a huge intelligence and police state apparatus that is getting fragile and fraying at the edges and therefore is very dangerous. And in the case of the Soviet example, it unraveled about as well as it could have, largely, I think, again, because Gorbachev was just a decent dude. So looking at the American system, my point of view is sort of like the best case scenario that we could probably hope for. I think the American empire is beyond the point of salvaging at this point. The question is just like, how does it fall apart and what's it replaced by? And you know, how soon does that happen? Does it manage to, you know, scrape by another 40, 50 years, or does it happen within the next decade or so? I don't know. But best case scenario for us would probably be if we got the American equivalent of a Gorbachev. Someone somehow became president who was like, going to try to reform the system, but, you know, ultimately can't, but who is a decent enough human being that they're not willing to try to use brute force to hold it together. And so, you know, would be willing to preside over an orderly dissolution of the American empire into smaller component parts. I think that's the best case scenario. Now, how likely that is, I don't know. Because I think,
You got a pretty good match right up until the end with Trump. I know a lot of people hate the guy, but I think overall he's a decent... Saying somebody's a decent person overall doesn't mean that you like everything about them or there's no bad shit about them. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, Trump is enough of a believer in America that if that happens under his watch, he may be less likely to, in, let's say, peacetime, line you up against a wall, shoot you, or put you in a camp. But I don't think it's beyond him to do it if it's like a, you know, early 90s Soviet collapse scenario, you know, where he feels the country is at threat of breaking apart. I don't necessarily think he would be a Gorbachev and let it go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he'd be likely to have, like, not on my watch kind
more
of
like a Lincoln,
kind of
right? Like, it doesn't matter what the issue is. The preservation of the Union is more important than anything else. If I got to free the slaves to do it, I'll do it. If I got to keep them to do it, I'll do it. But the Union must stand. Like, that was who Lincoln really was. And I think Trump is, in some ways, like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure, you know, of the people that are even around on the scene, you know, is anybody up to the job of being the American Gorbachev? I don't know. I've sort of wondered if, like, maybe someone like Tulsi Gabbard or RFK Jr. might not be, like, our best bet for an American Gorbachev. You know,
maybe.
Yeah, I agree with you that Trump seems likely to kind of, like, just knee-jerk, not on my watch kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to make America great again. Well, that doesn't involve allowing it to break up into a bunch of, you know, separate self-governing republics or whatever.
Because, I mean, my thing would be, like, let's say California, Oregon, Washington all said, fuck it, we're out of here. Bye. How can we help? Right? Yeah. How can we help? Right? Do we need to give relocation assistance to your Eastern citizens that don't want to go with you? How can we help you? Can we set up charges along the San Andreas Fault and just push you out to sea a little bit? Like, it's okay. You can go. But I don't think the Orange Man would be down with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm totally willing to let, you know, the West Coast of the U.S. go be its own woke North Korea.
Yeah.
If that's, you know, what those people really want. But
the beauty of it would be, okay, show us. Show us how it works. Make it work without all of us, without all those farmers in Kansas and Nebraska and shit feeding you. For all the talk of like California feeding the country, California feeds the country vegetables. There's no calories in vegetables, right? The calories for the people that don't eat meat come from grain. And most of the people who eat meat in this country, the calories that feed the cows come from grain, right? California is not a big grain producer. Right, they're not a big cow. They have some fruits and nuts and shit like that. There's lots of fruits and nuts in California, but they're not feeding the country calorically. So just that alone would be interesting to see them try to make. I bet you they would all of a sudden discover a love for offshore drilling, really, really fast, really, really fast when they were on their own. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, another or kind of a wild card that makes me wonder, like, how much more volatile and dangerous the American imperial collapse is this, that the American people are so well armed. Now, I'm in favor of that, but at the same time, it does introduce a lot of volatility into the process, because all it would take is a relatively small number of yahoos to go out and start, you know, shooting people up in the name of some, you know, political dissident movement or in the name of some secessionist movement or whatever, whether it's real or false flagged or whatever, it doesn't even really matter. It wouldn't take very much for things to go off the rails in terms of political violence, lone nuts taking things into their own hands, trying to start, you know, people deciding like, all right, I'm going to be the new Red Dawn or whatever and go fight the government. And that can turn ugly in a lot of ways. If the government still has enough staying power, it can result in them just cracking down with sheer brute force to hold the system together. That's not good. It could also just turn into chaos. I mean, you could end up theoretically in a situation where you have a huge version of like the troubles in Northern Ireland or a huge version of like Yugoslavia in the 90s.
Yeah.
That's
we're a lot bigger and we have a lot more guns and we have a lot more. One thing this country has a ton of, and it's why the government sees them as a threat, is veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I wasn't special forces or some shit like that. But you give me five dudes and 3 months, three months to train five dudes that aren't even really there yet. They don't really know anything. They've got their shit together and they're willing to do it. And I will build you a 6-man team that will fuck some shit up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and one of the things Colonel Miller said, I had him on last week. And he was a little bit too much the Chicken Little Sky's Falling for me, but he was talking about like if you did have these like breakup type of thing in the United States, let's say California goes, and let's say like my philosophy is kept, like bye, see ya. Well, what about all those people in Eastern California where it's all red that don't want to go? And then by the way, all those people that want to go, they have no guns. All the people that don't want to go got all the guns. I mean, sometimes I'm like, the left really doesn't understand you're trying to start a civil war with the people that have all the guns and know how to use them, and you don't have any guns, and you don't know how to use them. And they think all of it will be done by proxy, by military and police. And I think people that say they'll never fire on the American citizens, I'm like, you know nothing. But all of them know, right? So you're going to have a break there. And so you could have these like minor shitstorms contained within like state-on-state violence, like interstate violence instead of intrastate violence is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could end up with like chaotic, chronic, low intensity, unconventional warfare. Again, you know, something sort of along the lines of the troubles in Northern Ireland in the late 20th century, where it's like there's sort of law and order. There's the police and the military in charge, but at the same time, there's this like messy insurgency going on.
Yeah.
And then you've got the established authorities of the government trying to suppress the insurgency. Meanwhile, there's like insurgents on the other side, right? Like they were Protestant, you know, paramilitaries and terrorists who were terrorists and paramilitaries in the name of the existing government, even though the existing government didn't actually support them, although covertly they sometimes did. And it just turns into this mess. And that's another possibility. And that has all kinds of problems, aside from the fact that, you know, innocent people tend to get killed in the crossfire in those sorts of conflicts. There's also like, what would it do to the American economy if we had Northern Ireland style, you know, guerrilla warfare brewing in multiple regions of the country in various chaotic ways? How does that hit the economy? What does that do to like supply chains? And, you know, it could be really bad. So, you know, there's a lot of ways this could play out. And a big part of it probably too is like, what part of the American empire are you in? Because when empires collapse, there's always some parts of that empire that do better and some parts of that empire that do worse. So, you know, where are you when the imperial shit hits the fan?
Yeah, yeah. So do you think there is any potential? First of all, do you think the United States empire, the American empire, is going to collapse in a relatively short time frame, which could be a decade or two, or could be 5 years, it could be 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, do you see, will our government let it happen as peacefully as possible, whatever that means? And I guess the last thing would be in that, and then we'll wrap, is could we have a collapse of empire globally, but the domestic component that is the United States not break up? Like, so instead of being the Soviet Union, let's imagine the Soviet Union didn't fall apart, but all the Warsaw states, Cuba, all that went away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the American system, as we know it, as it exists right now, will cease to exist in my lifetime. Now, what that means could be many things. It could mean, best case scenario, we get an American Gorbachev and a peaceful, you know, dissolution of the American empire into smaller pieces that are not as oppressive and horrible as the existing system. It could also mean that the American kind of fake democracy, oligarchical, dysfunctional republic ceases to exist, and what replaces it is like a nakedly totalitarian state. Not my preferred option for obvious reasons. But you know, that's a possibility in the same way that like, you know, the Tsar's empire declined and collapsed. Okay, great. But what replaced it was the Bolshevik empire. So, you know, who eventually made the Tsar look like not such a bad guy by comparison. So, you know, there's the possibility of that. You know, I don't agree with the establishment that Trump's going to be our Hitler who does that, but, you know, someone else might for sure. And I actually see it more likely to be done under a weak leader who's being sort of like, you know, pushed by, behind the scenes, you know, people in the intelligence agencies and the corporate world and the Pentagon and stuff like that. You know, an empty suit sock puppet like a Kamala Harris is probably more dangerous in terms of things going authoritarian.
I kind of look at it this way, like a country, any country is like a sculling team in a boat. And with the president or prime minister, whoever the top executive is, it's got a rudder. And there's still a lot of control that exists by the rowers, no matter what I do with the rudder, but I can do something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I put a guy back there or a gal back there that will do whatever I tell them to with that rudder, there might as well not be a rudder. Now the rowers are in command, mm-hmm. right? And I think that describes a Kamala Harris or a Joe Biden perfectly. That's where mm-hmm. we're at. We have a rudderless ship, but the rowers can steer the ship,
mm-hmm.
right? But there's no one to say, like, I don't want to go that port. I want to go to starboard, right? There's no one to do that right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, I think they want to lose. I said that yesterday when we had all the geese here. But I also think, like, they want to lose, but they'll take a win. And mm-hmm. so we'll just throw this. I also think the reason we ended up with Kamala, and I said this before it happened, as soon as that debate happened, I said, Biden's going to drop out within 30 days and Kamala Harris will be the replacement. Everybody told me how stupid I was. And I'm like, it's the only play they have. And the reason it was the only play they have, they had $110 million in their war chest for the campaign. The only person they could just give it to was her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they would have, like, I mean, if they wanted to win, they would have grabbed a hold of RFK and figured out a way to get him in there. But they couldn't have given him the money. It's not clean. You can't just do that, you know? Like, they were too close. And I think, like, Trump's biggest mistake of this whole campaign was doing that debate.
Mm.
I think as soon as they said they were going to do that debate, I'm like, oh, I hope he doesn't do that bad. Because I thought that's exactly what they did. Like, well, we can't have this after the convention, because that's typically when debates happen, right? Like, we can't have it. And I think so. I think you're dead on it, CJ, as we're coming back to where you're at, as that if they lose, the other guy's holding the hot potato at the end of the game. If they win, well, we have our empty suit that will do whatever we want. Mm-hmm. And so, like, create a scenario where even when you lose, you win. I think that's where they're at with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, on the question of, you know, what about if the U.S., like, kind of, you know, stops trying to be the world empire and the world policeman.
Yeah.
Stops trying to expand NATO, like, to Antarctica or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of goes through something closer to, like, what the British went through or the French went through, where, you know, they let go of the parts of their empire that were far away and overseas. They stopped trying to, you know, be the world policeman militarily, but their government at home, like, stayed more or less the same, and, you know, didn't break up or get overthrown in a revolution or whatever. I think that's another interesting possibility, and again, it requires the right political leadership. And again, I'm skeptical that you know, Trump or Kamala is going to preside over, like, bringing the troops home across the board. You know, I wish Trump was more disciplined and consistent about a lot of that stuff, because he occasionally says good things about, you know, why do we even have NATO? And, you know, we shouldn't fight these stupid wars in the Middle East. Like, he says good things, but then he tends to not follow through.
Yeah.
Yeah. He tends to not follow through, because then, you know, some Zionist gets his ear and tells him, oh, we got to stay in the Middle East because we got to support Israel. And don't you love Israel? And he's like, oh, gee whiz, we do. So, you know, you would need the right people in charge. You would need somebody with kind of like a plan and principles and the backbone to stick to it, even when all the generals and intelligence agency guys are telling you it's a bad idea. You need somebody in the same way that Kennedy stood up to those people in the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, a lot of his generals and intelligence bigwigs and whatever, they were telling Kennedy, like, just go ahead and start World War III. And Kennedy had to stand up to them and be the you know, restraint in his own administration and say, no, we don't want to end life on Earth over this if we don't have to. Let's see if we can figure out a way to negotiate and do a deal. And he did a deal, and he got, you know, the missiles out of Cuba without World War III. And that required him to have the huevos and the backbone to stand up to all these, you know, Curtis LeMay generals with all the fancy medals on their chests saying, no, Mr. President, you don't want to be a pansy. You want to stand up to the Ruskies. Yeah, yeah. And it took him having to
be seen as weak in front of the Russians on the world stage, sir.
Yeah.
Right? If we have to blow up all life on Earth, that's the cost. Like, that's literally how these morons think.
Yeah. And, you know, most American politicians of both parties right now, they would not have the backbone to stand up against the military-industrial complex and the intelligence agencies the way Kennedy did. They just wouldn't. You know, whether it's Trump or Kamala, they're likely to let themselves be led around by those people and manipulated by those people into doing things. So, yeah, I mean, that would probably be the second best case scenario, I guess, for the collapse of the American empire, is if, you know, the ruler started rationally closing down the overseas empire and bringing the troops home and put us on a path towards becoming like something like a giant version of Switzerland.
Okay.
That would be, especially if it was accompanied by like a return to more federalism, if it was, you know, accompanied by, we're going to hand more authority back to the states. Like, we
actually follow the 9th and 10th amendment of the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be great.
That would be great. That would be, but in the words of what Bill from, Office Space, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen, right? Like,
yeah.
Because I would be kind of down with that. I would think that would be like the best possible outcome. Let's not have military bases in 100 plus countries, right? Yeah. Let's not keep giving all these countries that hate us money. let's actually build shit in the country again, instead of, especially the things that are actually core and I don't give a shit that we get all kinds of gimmicky crap and consumer level shit from China. I don't care. I care that we get our steel from foreign countries. I care that we get our aluminum from foreign countries. I care that we get the raw materials to make our antibiotics from foreign countries. I care that we buy the chipsets that we need to build the technology that we use in our military from foreign countries. All of these seem like a dramatically bad idea to me. Like, I just don't think that none of that makes any sense. And if we started doing those things, I think, like, then you don't have an empire collapse. You have the reestablishment of the republic that we're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm not holding out a lot of hope for it. Yeah.
I mean, I wish I had a simple answer to the whole thing of, you know, I've read the historical tea leaves, and I've got good news. I know for sure how it's all going to play out, and it's going to play out in this way that's, you know, not so bad and going to have a happy ending. Like, you know, if I was in the bullshit business, that'd be what I would tell you. You know, I would say that it can go relatively well. If you would have asked me if I was like an omniscient historical observer standing outside of time, and you asked me in like 1980, and you said, hey, the Soviet Union is going to be gone in a decade. How do you think it's going to play out? You think it's going to be, you know, mostly peaceful? I'd have been like, no. Probably yeah. There'll be massive, you know, ethnic civil wars all over the place, and there's a good chance it'll go nuclear. There's a good chance that Moscow is going to try and, like, you know, go down with the ship in a way or something like that. I would have never predicted, like, no, it's going to be mostly peacefully. It's going to be, you know, a bunch of political dissidents who just stand up against the system and protest and stuff. And, you know, there's going to be a leader in Moscow who's going to, like, you know, basically give in to those people and not use brute force to try and snuff them out. I would have never thought that would have played out. So, you know, that's why.
I mean, what I would have thought
provides hope.
I would have thought that the satellite republics and maybe the Warsaw would have rebelled. Russia would have attacked them. And then we, in our infinite wisdom, would have said, we have to go help them fight for freedom.
Yep.
And some new rehashed version of domino theory or some bullshit. Because, like, gee, that's not happening now, is it? We're not invoking domino theory. If Putin takes Ukraine, which he's not even trying to do. He's trying to take this little tiny strip of land. If he takes that, he'll run all over Europe. Like, I feel like I heard this movie before. The popcorn's stale, the floor's sticky. I don't want to be in this theater. Like, can I not do this with you? But that's the problem. Like, and that's why we're having this conversation. We can't make the decision to not do this with them. Like, this is going to affect us one way or another. I'm all for parallel societies and rebuilding. But if people start throwing friggin' nuclear bombs around or some shit, or if you actually destroy the country's infrastructure, if you destroy our economy, if you fuck things up to the point we can't get necessary materials into the country, I mean, look how close we came to everybody shitting their pants over a longshoreman strike, right? Like, that's a cakewalk compared to where some of this stuff could go. So I don't know that we have a good way out of this. I do think we need to stay alert, stay aware.
Yeah.
You want to tell people, though, you do have a course that will go into this at, like, a really deep level, and how they can learn more about that and how they can subscribe to your podcast.
Sure. Yeah. So my podcast is Dangerous History Podcast. You can find it, you know, on whatever podcatcher app or platform you like to use for your audio podcasts. I do have a YouTube channel and other stuff going too. And dangeroushistorypodcast.com will take you to sort of my homepage. But yeah, I'm going to be teaching. I don't know yet exactly when, because it depends on the timing of when it hits its initial funding goal. But I'm doing a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo, and it is to for me to teach an online 4-part course called The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Empire. So it's going to be, you know, on the stuff we've been talking about today, but going through it in, you know, greater detail with, you know, a lot more just, you know, granular historical detail about the stories. And I'm really going to try and zero in as much as I can on stuff I don't think most Americans know, as far as, you know, putting the story, looking at the story mostly from the communist perspective of how it played out and why it played out the way it did. So it's going to be 4 parts in depth, going all the way from the death of Stalin in the 50s up through, you know, recent history and the breakdown of American-Russian relations in this century, in the aftermath of the Cold War. And you can sign up to take the course with me live for $250, which is a bargain considering, last I checked, to take one community college class at a Florida community college with in-state tuition, which is, you know, some of the most affordable in the country, still is over $300.
Okay.
And I promise you that you're going to learn more from my online class than you're going to learn in a community college class. Especially, I can guarantee that because I no longer teach community college. You know, back when I was doing that, I could have said, well, maybe if you take a class with me at community college. But now, yeah, you're definitely going to learn more here. You can also sign up. It's going to be Tuesday nights, four consecutive Tuesdays in a row at 8 p.m. Eastern. And if you can't make it Tuesday nights, or, you know, you just want to spend a little less money or whatever, I also have an option where you can buy for $175, you can get access to recordings of the course sessions after they're done. So you won't be there listening to me live, able to ask me questions, discuss and interact and whatever like that. But, you know, for $175, you'll, you know, get access to recordings of all the course sessions. And you are going to, I promise, no matter how well read you are on this thing, you are going to learn something that you didn't know before. And my goal is that it gives you a lot to think about in terms of trying to wrap your head around understanding, you know, how these things play out and how the American imperial collapse could play out. So, go check that out, and yeah, hopefully it'll make its initial funding goal soon, and then I'll have a few more weeks to keep trying to recruit students to it. But yeah, I'm excited about this. I mean, frankly, you know, I need the dough to help me get through the rest of the year. I've been going through a lot myself and my family lately, trying to keep our heads above water financially. But I'm really excited that I have, you know, a way to try and raise money and get us through the rest of the year that is something cool that I'm excited to do, been wanting to do for a long time, you know, to teach a course 100% my way, no limitations whatsoever, exactly what I want to teach, how I want to teach it. So if that sounds like something that you all listening would be interested in, go check it out and sign up, and I'd love to have you in the course.
Well, and we talk about parallel economies. We talk about parallel societies. We talk about open source education. Folks, if you believe in all that and you want to know more about history, and specifically the history of the last great empire that collapsed, I mean, that's the way I would put it. Like, it's the closest to now that we've watched an empire collapse would be the Soviet Union. I would say, going back in time from there, the British Empire. Like, those two are the recent examples we have, because I believe we're on track for this. And I don't know what it looks like, because, like I said, I would have got the Soviet thing wrong too. And I don't mean young, dumbass, 18-year-old Jack Spirko would have got it wrong. 20-something Jack Spirko would have got it wrong, what was going on. I would have got it wrong if I had all the wisdom that I've acquired in my life right now, in my 50s, and you put me back in time, and I didn't know the future, but I had the experience and the knowledge. I still would not have gotten it right. So I don't think we can ever know. What is the saying, CJ? You're the historian, right? History doesn't really repeat, but it often rhymes.
Yep.
And I think that's the best thing we can do, is look for the places it's rhyming. And of course it won't be the same, but it will be the same. I mean, that's it's not maybe the happiest thing people want to hear from me, but it, I do believe, is actually the truth. But man, I think people should definitely sign up for your course. And if nothing else, man, get over to CJ's site and find all the different platforms he's on. He's on Fountain, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all that shit. Whatever one you use, subscribe to this podcast and start listening to him. You have a lot to learn from this man. There's a reason I was excited to get him back on the show. CJ, thank you for coming back, and I'm willing to have you back anytime you want to come have a conversation.
Oh, thank you very much, Jack. I appreciate that. And yeah, check out my show. And I should also mention, you know, the best way to support me on like an ongoing, continual basis is through my Patreon. And I've got literally several hundred episodes of Dangerous History, just for supporting listeners on Patreon, that are no longer available to the general public. So, you know, for even just a few bucks a month, you can get access to hundreds of additional hours of Dangerous History. I've been doing this show for a little bit over a decade now. Awesome. So there's a lot of stuff in the back catalog to explore.
And then for folks that are listening to this, if you get on my website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, if it's sometime in the future when you finally hear this episode, episode 3579, just stick 3579 in the subject or the search box. It'll pull it up. If you're watching the video and you want to get in touch with CJ through his social media, take his course, subscribe to his podcast, There's a link right down there in the video notes, right at the top. If you click that link, it'll go over to the audio version. If we're still live and you click it right now, it won't go anywhere because we're not quite done just yet, but we will be soon. CJ, thank you for being with us today.
Very welcome. My pleasure.
All right, folks, real quick before we sign off, I want to remind you of a couple of ways that you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work that we do. You know, I'm big on gardening. I teach gardening all the time. But building your garden beds can be expensive and it can be time-consuming. Vivor doesn't have 100% great products, but they have some great products. And this is one of them. I have sold hundreds of their galvanized raised garden beds. I own two of them. They're fantastic. They are easy to put together. Putting one together is like a one beer job, maybe a two beer job, depending on how much you like your beer. It's easy. It's simple. And with the cost of lumber today, it costs less to build one of these in a few minutes than to go get the material and get all that wood and all the screws and everything from Home Depot or Lowe's to bring it home and build it that way. I actually break the numbers down in the review that I did here of what it would cost you to build a bed of the same depth and dimensions out of pressure treated lumber. And that's when they weren't on sale and it was still a good deal. So they're on sale right now. You can get the 2 foot deep, 4x8 beds shipped to you in a box. It's not very big because they come in panels that you bolt together. For about $80. You cannot build a 4x8x2 foot deep raised bed out of pressure treated lumber for $80. It's not doable with current lumber prices. This thing is going to last pretty much until you're dead. Pressure treated lumber will eventually rot and fail, even though it's pressure treated. So, check these out again. It's a great deal on them. Fall garden season is not coming. It's here. But if you're going to do any growing through your winter, now is the time to get it in. Or if you're just going to get those beds ready and let everything settle in, get that soil active for spring, now's the time to put it in. And it ain't too late to throw some cover crops on there. So also consider taking my backyard cover crop and soil secrets course. This course is $80. It is a hell of a deal. It is a 9-chapter course, 12 hours of instruction. You will know more about soil science than most people that work in the soil science space, honestly, like in NRCS and stuff like that. If you take this course, you'll truly understand it. You won't just know how to cover crop your backyard. You'll know how to evaluate what you've done. You'll know whether or not you should make changes. You'll know when you should do it. You'll figure out how your timing works in your area. The questions you ask me, what mix, when do I plant it, how do I term it, all that, you'll be able to figure it out for yourself. For only $80. And MSB members, you can get it for $65. So that's a hell of a deal as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, guys, need to wrap up. We're 2 hours and 21 minutes. This is a long one because that's just the fact CJ and having conversations with him is just awesome. I hope you take a lot from today's episode because this is in our future. Exactly what it looks like, as CJ and I both told you, I don't know. I have no idea what the end of American empire looks like. I do know we're reaching the end of America's empire because it is completely unsustainable. Economically, it is not sustainable. Politically, it is not sustainable. The global appetite for it is unsustainable. There is no piece of it that is sustainable. Therefore, this must occur. Whether it's peaceful and a breakup, whether it's peaceful and basically just calling home everybody, whether it is just a sea change in how we do business or whether it is an absolute catastrophe is unknown. But that it is going to occur, I think that is as much a known as anything. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow with an expert council Q&A show for the week. This is going to be a good one. I've already got all the experts selected for tomorrow. It's going to be great. It will be on Halloween, though there won't really be any Halloween theming to it or anything. We're not going to do another zombie episode. Then we'll have that flashback next week. Regularly scheduled programming through the week. Jack is back, but it's just as quick as I'm back. It's going to happen again. We have the workshop coming up the following week. It will all be rewinds, flashbacks, etc. On event week. But we will be live streaming the workshops. Everything that's done indoors, everything that's in the shop, which is pretty much everything we're doing this year. We're not doing any field level projects, a couple walkarounds and stuff like that. But everything other than that will be streamed for free on our YouTube channel. Why YouTube? Because one destination is easier when you're dealing with all those variables. So it will also end up on Odyssey and Rumble, etc. as archives. But we will be doing live streaming, zero cost, and you will be able to use the chat to communicate with our AV people and participate. Again, This is not like we're selling for $50 or something. We've talked about it. Dorothy and I just decided that, you know, those of you that can't be here, we just want you to be able to be part of it if you want to see what goes on and what happens. So we're going to continue that tradition. We've been doing it for like 5 years now. Stream it for free for you guys. Anyway, with that, I will catch you guys tomorrow with that expert counsel show.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Show you a better way.